I wondered if he even felt the sharp stab of pain as his hip checked one of the desks and sent him stumbling forward. I took a step to follow him out, but caught myself. Cole raised his brows, his eyes sliding over to meet mine in a silent question. I shook my head. No, I wasn't going to go after him. I could feel guilty about forcing him to relive that time in his life for a few minutes, but I wasn't going to comfort him or try to shield him from his own horrific memories of Los Angeles. How could I, when part of me was glad that he was just as miserable over it as I was? You didn't drop the bombs on the city, I thought. But neither had he. Nico hadn't planned the attack carried out by the military. He hadn't been responsible for the agents overthrowing Alvin in a bloody midnight coup that fractured the League forever. He hadn't... I pressed the heel of my palm against my forehead. I didn't want to think about this now. It was like prodding a swollen, angry blister that hadn't popped yet. I needed to focus on Thurmond, on the fact that, apparently, we had less than 2 months to not only gather supplies, but find additional kids, train them, figure out transportation, get to Nevada, get back from Nevada. The impossibility of it rose over me. A mountain that only stretched higher and higher into the sky the closer I got to it.
We'll meet with everyone tonight to settle the plan, Cole was saying. We'll clarify the goal we're working toward, focus everyone's energy. In the meantime...
Yes, yes, of course. I'll make contact with the Canadians, see what they might be willing to do for us about ammunition and gas. Senator Cruz ran a comforting hand down my arm, then squeezed my hand. I barely felt it.
You are the queen of my heart, Madam Senator, Cole informed her with a devastatingly handsome smile.
Oasis, she reminded him, heading toward the door.
We'll meet in here at 7 sharp, Cole said. I'll have a plan ready for you.
She paused, turning back to look at him. It was there and gone faster than a blink, but I saw the moment she let herself hope. Thank you. I waited until she was gone before leaning forward and resting my head against one of the empty desks. Closing my eyes didn't make the headache any better. In fact, the glassy film over my thoughts thickened as I turned my mind back in the direction of Thurmond. I felt myself sit up, suddenly flooded with images of men in black uniforms tearing the camp down before I could do it, destroying every last piece of evidence before the world could see what had really happened there.
Ruby?
Cole was waving at me from further down the row of computers, an odd expression on his face.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I said, rubbing at my irritated eyes. Why?
You just... We're staring around the room, but you didn't.
I was alert again, at least, pulling myself out of the slow, dulled, shapeless thoughts I'd sunken into. I'm fine, I interrupted him. So, the plans, the ones the kids made? You've read them?
Yeah,
he said, slipping into Nico's seat in front of the laptop and clicking around.
They're not bad, but I seem to remember a better one.
Whose?
Yours. He said pointedly. You put together a whole plan for hitting Thurmond, remember? Gave it to Alvin, behind Connor's back?
I had, hadn't I? 3 months ago might as well have been 3 years ago at this point. When they'd taken my plan and twisted it, wanting to use it to arm kids with explosive devices and send them into camps, it had been like they'd cut off my legs at the knees. They'd turned a dream into a nightmare.
This thing about Thurmond, it sucks. I know that's a crappy word to express the magnitude of how terrible it is, but it just plain sucks, and we're going to have to work harder and faster now. We have until the beginning of March to get our act together. It would help to have a fully formed plan to run with so we can jump into action, the one you spent months thinking through.
Cole picked up a small notepad he'd tucked into the folder of handwritten plans from the other kids and tossed it to me.
Here, write it out. Everything you remember from your original idea. I'll work on combining everyone's ideas into something cohesive and realistic for tonight's meeting.
I found a pen in one of the desk drawers at the front of the computer room and sat down to write. The first words were halting, and I was self-conscious of the loops and uneven lines of my terrible handwriting. The longer I wrote, the easier it felt. The words came trickling back slowly, like they didn't fully trust that this time it would be different, that this was worth getting my hopes up for all over again. This is different. One kid enters the camp ahead of the assault with a tiny camera installed on a pair of glasses, so images of the interior of the camp can be relayed back to headquarters and the op strategy can be mapped out. Cole promised this would happen. We take their own transportation in, blindside the PSFs and camp controllers, subdue them without killing them. If you can't believe in this, then neither will they. We'll leave one camp controller free under my influence to report back in status updates until we're all away. It took up 10 whole sheets, front and back, and my writing got more and more illegible as excitement started fizzing in my blood again, and I could see each of these moments unfolding with perfect clarity. By the end, my hand was cramped, and I felt drained, but my head was clear. I did feel better. Calm, at least, which wasn't nothing. I stood up and turned back toward where he was still sitting. Every now and again I heard voices and sounds coming from his direction, and the part of my brain that wasn't distracted by my work knew that he was watching the videos we'd downloaded. The crying, the soft begging, the questions that never had answers. They were the kinds of things I'd learned to tune out at Thurmond for my own self-preservation. I don't know what it would have done to me to have nightmares every single night. The light from the screen flashed across his face, thrown onto the wall behind him. I lingered by my desk, caught by his bleak expression. Moving a few steps back, I was able to see what he was watching reflected in the windows lining the wall. Fire streaked across the screen. Coal glowed orange, red, gold, as the light from the video bathed him in deadly color. And just like that, my small slice of peace was gone, washed out by sudden, cold understanding. The hair on the back of my neck prickled. The video zoomed in on the face of a young boy, no more than 13, strapped to some kind of metal post. He was panting hard, thrashing against the restraints that trapped his arms against his sides. There were small electrodes dotting his shaved head, ringing his scalp with a crown of wires. Revulsion rose in me, bile burning its way up my throat. I pressed a hand against my face and had to work up the courage to watch the terrible truth of it. Cole glanced at me once as I stood behind him, then turned back to the screen. It was as much of an invitation as I was going to get. He started the video again from the beginning, and it was that much worse to hear the Red's guttural sounds and screaming mixed with the scientist's calm, dry notations to the camera.
They were testing the kid to see what kind of emotional response triggers his abilities, Cole said, staring at the last frozen close-up of the boy's face, streaming with sweat and tears. Trying to map the way his mind processed it. Ruby, he said, turning so his face was in profile. After tonight, after we have our op strategy, I want you to do everything in your power to find Lillian Gray. Everything. Do you understand?
Yes, I said, finally finding the words as he started the video over again. I do. 10. I left the computer lab in another glassy daze, walking and walking with nothing but the images of all those kids trapped inside of my head. Burns, surgeries, blood being drawn, questions, so many variations of what's happening and why are you doing this? Even if my mind was checked out, my body at least knew where it wanted to go. This whole day had passed like a year spent underwater. I just wanted to go to sleep for a little while and try surfacing again later. The others had claimed one of the empty bunk rooms on the lower level. I had my own creaky bed and everything. Truthfully, though, I would have curled up in the corner of one of the halls on the cold tile, as long as it meant shutting my eyes for a little while. Someone clearly had the same idea. The overhead light was off, but a smaller, desk-sized one was on, perched on top of the crappy little dresser on the other side of the room. I hadn't realized how badly I wanted to see him until he was there, and a little glow lit at my center. Liam was sprawled across one of the bottom bunks on his stomach, his face turned away, his hands tucked up under the folded sweatshirt he was using as a pillow. His hair and back were still damp from the shower he must have taken. "Hey," I said, coming toward him. A small test of sorts to gauge his mood. If he wanted to be left alone, I'd turn and go without a second's hesitation. Instead, his shoulders, then the rest of his body, visibly relaxed. I dropped my knee on the free space at the edge of the bare mattress. His hand automatically moved to hook his arm around it.
"Hey yourself,"
Liam mumbled. He didn't sound sleepy, but he did sound wrung out.
"Time for dinner?"
"Not yet. How's the garage looking?"
"Getting there. You can see half of the floor now. That's an improvement, right?"
he said, finally lifting his head and turning toward me.
"Present for you."
I followed his gaze over to the dresser, where there was a square of clear plastic to the left of the lamp. I picked it up and laughed. It was a CD case. The Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. I popped it open, smiling at the liner notes and disc inside.
"It's like our song is following us everywhere,"
he said. He meant, "Wouldn't it be nice," the opening track. I smiled. "Our song?"
"Wouldn't it be nice if we were older?"
His soft voice trailed off into a hum.
"I figured you could use some pleasant background music to drown out the sounds of you and Cole beating the shit out of each other, if it's going to be an every morning kind of thing."
The warmth at my center evaporated. I closed the case, pressing it against my chest.
"How did you know?" "The two of you were the only ones that showed up to breakfast with new bruises. It's not that hard to put two and two together."
He finally looked up at me.
"Please. Please be careful. The thought of him hitting you, pushing you around, it just makes me want to kill him."
"It's just sparring. I have to train."
"And you couldn't ask Vida?"
I felt myself heat up. "Are you implying something?" I didn't want to explain this to him. I shouldn't have to explain. It had nothing to do with him. I started to pull back, but his hand reached out again and caught mine.
"No, damn it. Of course not. I'm sorry. That's not the reason."
He closed his eyes and sighed.
"I found it in the car they'd stripped. It's glove box. I brought it because it made me think of you."
I reached over, placing it on top of the nearest dresser.
"Sorry, I've got a real knot in my tail today,"
he said, turning those blue eyes up on me again. I felt frustration retract its claws from my stomach.
"And I know you can take care of yourself, but it still drives me crazy to think about it. I guess I'm being a hypocrite, considering how close I came to hitting you this morning."
He'd spent the whole day hauling junk around, trying to put it into some kind of order, and that was after having his brother read him the riot act. Of course he was entitled to be short with me. I sat down on the edge of the bed. "You didn't hurt me. Hey, I mean it. Not even close. I wouldn't have jumped in if I didn't know I could block you." I picked up his hand, folding his thumb toward his palm and the other four fingers over it. "Plus, you had your fist like this, and that's a good way to break your thumb." I pressed my lips to his knuckles to show I was just teasing. Finally, finally, I was rewarded with a smile. His soft cotton shirt had ridden up his back slightly, exposing a sliver of skin. I wanted to touch it. So I did. I dragged his shirt up that much farther as I worked my fingers up and down his back in soft strokes.
"Feels nice,"
he whispered.
"Will you stay? I don't want to see anyone but you for a while."
He moved back toward the wall, a silent invitation to slide into the small bunk beside him. It felt so good and easy now. I knew exactly how we fit together, as if we'd been cut from the same pattern. "You okay?" I asked, fingers worrying the front of his shirt. Liam wrapped an arm around my waist, drawing me closer. Everything that came out of the laundry practically reeked of detergent and bleach, including the shirt he wore. But underneath it all was this scent that was all warm skin and evergreens and mint toothpaste. And that was Liam. The scent had a drugging effect on my system. I took in one steadying breath after another.
Just dog-tired, darling.
The silence that followed was the first true spell of calm I'd experienced in months. It was the dim, shadowed light, the steady rise and fall of his chest against my cheek, his warmth pressed against mine. All of these things conspired against me. One moment I was awake, Liam's fingers carefully stroking the loose hair back out of my face. The next, I was slipping into a slow, sweet doze. The soft kiss was the only thing to bring me out of it.
"Dinner time," he said, his own voice sounding rough from sleep. "They just shouted down the hall."
And yet, neither of us moved.
"What did you do today?"
he asked after a while.
I didn't even ask.
"Are you sure you want to know?" He leaned back at that, the focus in his eyes sharpening.
"I got us into Clancy's private collection of files. Besides a list of the different tribes and their last known locations, it basically was a digital scrapbook of nightmares."
"How did you get access?"
Now it was my turn to fix him with a look.
"The usual way?" I watched his reaction carefully, already feeling the words settle between us, add to that space. They were an unwelcome reminder. This is what I do. This is who I am.
He took it in stride. "Was there anything about the cure on there?"
"A bit about the testing they did at Thurmond to find the cause, but it turns out that they're going to close Thurmond down at the end of March."
"Aw, damn," he said. "I'm sorry."
"Cole still wants to plan a hit."
"Well, I guess 2 months is better than 2 weeks," he said. "We'll figure it out. But can I ask you something? And can I get an honest answer out of you?"
I bristled a bit at that.
"This quartermaster thing you suggested, me being in charge of supplies, is it a consolation prize?"
"What do you mean?"
"Is this a way to keep me here? Keep me behind, I mean. When things get rolling with the camps, am I going to be left waiting here hoping everybody comes back in one piece?"
"You mean exactly what we're all going to be doing while you're out looking for supplies?" I said. "No. And for what it's worth, Cole was only panicking because you didn't tell him where you were going. It was the same for me. You were just gone. I know you can fight if you have to, but I don't know that he does."
"He has no idea what I've been through, what I've had to do. He acts like I don't even know how to use a gun."
His hands bunched up the back of my shirt.
"I do, though. Harry taught me before I left home. I just don't want to shoot one unless I have to."
"That's the way it should be," I told him. "Sometimes I can't believe that this is happening to us, and I wonder when it became so natural to pick up a gun and act like it's nothing. I have to teach the other kids how to shoot, and I have no idea how I'm going to do it. I don't know how to show them how absurd and terrible it is that they even have to learn."
"Maybe it doesn't have to be that way," he said quietly. "Maybe we don't have to actually show up with guns blazing."
I'm not sure I could have been more surprised if he'd suggested we should just go straight to the top and assassinate Gray. I'd based my camp liberation plan on the one he and the others had come up with at East River, and both involved considerable use of force.
"No, it has to be a real fight," I said. "They have to take us seriously. The thing is, what I can't get over is how the kids will take it. What'll happen if they find themselves in the position to kill and pull the trigger? We can train them to study their nerves, and we can give them targets to practice with, but it feels like forcing them to drink poison that'll never leave their system. I know it's a sacrifice and that they'll be the ones choosing to make it, but I worry about the cost. I'm afraid of what we'll be at the end of the road."
"Look what it's done to us." Zoo's crying face the other night floated to the forefront of my mind, only to be replaced by the memory of Chubbs's confession about the requirements of becoming a skip tracer, him being shot, Liam's battered face. All of these were linked in my mind now. They'd never fade, not even in the afterlight of all of this.
"I think they understand more than you'd think," he said, tracing a finger along the edge of my ear. "The kids who aren't League have been out there running for years. No one is innocent here. They want it just as bad as we do. We'll figure out a way to keep them as safe as possible. We'll take care of them."
"Is that enough?"
"It will be."
Liam's kiss was unbearably tender.
"I missed this. Us talking, I mean."
A bolt of guilt shot through me at his words, at how content he sounded.
"Everything else seems crazy," Liam said, one hand threading through my loose hair. "Let's just stay here, you and me, and not let anyone or anything else in for a while, okay?"
This was the danger of him. In an instant, he could lift everything off my shoulders and set it aside. He became the answer to every doubt and lingering question. My world refocused, settling on him. Beautiful, perfect him. I didn't have to think about what I'd done, what would happen to us, even 5 minutes from now. Maybe he would never forgive me, not fully, but there was no thinking in this. If I couldn't bear every secret to him, unload everything in my heart, at least I could be close to him this way. He wanted comfort, and so did I. I nodded and brushed my lips as soft as a breath just behind his ear. The response was instant. A shudder ran through him, and it became a challenge to get that response from him again and again. He rolled over on top of me, and I shifted to draw my legs around his. He pressed down to capture my mouth, and I froze at the friction between us. Liam pulled back, bracing his elbows on either side of my head, his brows drawing together as he studied my face. I felt myself flood with color, the way it spread down my throat, across my chest. It wasn't the first time I'd felt how much he wanted me, but here, in this room, on this bed, it felt like more of a decision that needed to be made. One I wasn't ready for.
"It doesn't have to be anything more than this," he said softly. "I don't want you to think it has to be. This is actually pretty damn great."
Fingers skimmed against my ribcage, ran along the edge of my sports bra. Every last ounce of his attention focused on my lips again.
"But if... when I went out, I made sure to get..."
The words were flustered, tangled up in one another. But I understood his meaning, and it sent a small, growing spiral of happiness through me. He wanted this enough that he'd thought ahead. He would take the necessary precautions.
"Days, weeks, years from now. When you're ready, so am I. Okay?"
I wondered if he could feel how quickly he'd dialed up my heartbeat with only a few words. I was close enough to see the pulse at the base of his throat, if the trembling in his hands hadn't already spoken for him. I wrapped my arms around his waist, drawing him down to me again. "What am I going to do with you?" I asked, only half joking. That tiny smile grew as he lowered his face toward mine.
"Oh, you could try out a thing or two."
"Like what kinds of things?" I teased, pulling back as he came forward. He made a small, impatient noise. "Things that'll get us in trouble?"
"You are trouble," he said. "Capital T and everything."
I pulled him down, cutting his laughter off before it had the chance to start. My kiss eased off under his touch, becoming slower, a sweet kind of lazy. It made me feel, for the first time in my life, that I actually had time. We could take that soft pace, explore. "Can we not go to dinner every night?" I asked as his lips left mine and started to work toward my throat.
"Okay," he whispered. "Works for me."
I didn't feel shy or clumsy when my hand slid under his shirt again and began to draw it up, off. I heard him whisper my name, the sound of it breathy and raw, and it was like a hit of a drug to my system. I wanted to hear it again. Again and again and again and again. There was a tentative knock on the door. Liam pulled back, breathing hard. It was hard to tell which looked more wild, his hair or his eyes. "Don't make a sound," I thought. "They'll go away." They seemed to. I let out a soft sigh as Liam settled back down over me, blocking the rest of the room with his broad shoulders. Then the door cracked open. Liam shot up so fast he nailed his head against the top bunk and actually half-tripped, half-fell onto the ground. Cold air hit my skin, and I looked down, realizing that at some point my own shirt had mysteriously vanished, only to reappear on the other end of the bunk's thin mattress.
"Hang on," Liam barked. "Just a sec."
I shoved the thing back over my head just as he bent to scoop his up off the floor. A small piece of folded paper fell out of his back pocket, fluttering to the ground softly. He stumbled over himself to get to the door before it could open the rest of the way, catching it in his hand. Liam filled the doorway with his body, preventing whoever was there from looking or coming in.
"Hey, sorry," came the timid voice, "but the showerhead is going crazy. Do you think you could fix it?"
Liam's whole posture relaxed.
"Now's not really a great time."
"The whole bathroom is flooding, and I'm really sorry. I didn't mean for it to happen."
"It's okay,"
Liam said, glancing back at me. His face was a portrait of apology. He held up one finger, motioning for me to wait. As soon as the door shut behind him, I set my mind to remaking his bed, refolding the top blanket one or both of us had managed to kick off at some point. My heel brushed something warm. Something that wasn't the cold tile. I bent down, retrieving the piece of paper that had fallen out of Liam's pocket. It had been folded over once into a smaller square, but it had opened as it hit the ground. My eyes were already taking in the neat letters carefully printed there before I could spare a thought to it being wrong. "Your name is Liam Stewart. You are 18 years old. Your parents are Harry and Grace Stewart. Cole is your brother, and Claire was your sister. You were in a camp, Caledonia, but you broke out. East River did burn. You were lost. You're in Lodi by choice because you want to stay with Chubbs, Zoo, and Ruby. You want to be here, helping them. Do not go, even if they tell you to. Do not go. Ruby can take your memories, but what you feel is the truth. You love her. You love her. You love her." I read the words again, and a third time, trying to make sense of them. Because the words were ones I knew, I recognized I was reading sentences, but my mind disengaged. It up and left the picture before my heart could make the connection. "Ruby can take your memories." It was a note to himself. To a future self, one he apparently was so sure would fall victim to my mind again. This was a cheat sheet. Security. Because clearly my word wasn't going to cut it. I could promise him over and over again that I'd never touch his mind again. But it meant nothing. I had done it once. The trust between us was already broken. I went cold to the core. The shock of it, jumping from his warm touch to this, it was too much. I was the ash brushed aside after the fire had finally been blown out. "You are so stupid, so stupid, so stupid. He doesn't trust you, no matter what he says. Stop." The world broke me out of the free fall I dropped into, and all at once the sensation of falling, sinking, eased. I said the word again, forcing my heart down out of my throat, stilling my thoughts. I said it again, and one more time, until my voice sounded like my own again, not some dry rasp. I paced the length of the room, trying to stop the torrent of thoughts shooting through my mind. Quick steps were moving down the hall, bare feet slapping against the tile. I panicked, shoving the note inside of the CD case just as Liam swept back into the room. He was drenched in random places, his left shoulder, down his right side, the back of his sweats, the fabric below his knees, and the expression on his face was the resigned look of someone nominated for sainthood against his will. I plastered a smile on my face, holding my breath in the hope it would keep me from crying. Just seeing his face was enough to start unraveling the binding I had wrapped around the hurt.
"So,"
he said, wiping his damp hair off his face.
"Apparently I have to stop telling people I know a little bit about plumbing, because a little bit is how to twist the knob to get the water to turn on and off." "What, I look that pathetic?"
No, not at all," I said.
"What's wrong?"
He took a step toward me.
"Your voice sounds..."
"I just realized it's almost 7, I said. "Cole wants us upstairs to talk through the plan for the camps. We should go."
His brow creased, but he stood back from the door, opening it for me. Just as I passed, he caught my shoulder and turned me back toward him. A droplet of water worked its way down from his hair, mapping out a trail on his cheek, over his jaw, down his throat as he swallowed hard. I couldn't meet his eyes as he studied me, and managed not to cringe as he leaned forward and pressed a sweet kiss to my cheek.
The others were only just starting to mill into the computer room, joining the greens who were rearranging the desks out of their usual tidy rows and dragging them against the wall so they lined the room instead. Nico had reclaimed the laptop and was sitting at one of the desks along the rear wall, his back toward us. Everyone else faced the old, marker-stained whiteboard and the map of the United States taped up next to it on the opposite end of the room. Chubbs was standing in front of the map, pushing in small red pins as Vida read something, city names, off a printed list.
"Nicely done with the brain voodoo, boo," she said when she saw us. "Consider your ass forgiven for not coming down to help us haul shit around the garage."
Chubbs glanced back over his shoulder, one hand still splayed out on the map.
"If we're going to try picking some of these groups up, we have 4 good options. There are at least 10 kids in Wyoming alone." "If they haven't already moved on," Liam pointed out. "Now who's Mr. Doom and Gloom?"
Chubbs shot back. Whatever Liam was about to say was preempted by his brother sweeping into the room like a tornado of energy, a visibly pleased Senator Cruz at his side. The rare glimpse of happiness on her features made her look 10 years younger. She smiled when she caught my gaze, giving a small, affirmative nod.
She'd done it then. She'd managed to secure some supplies for us.
Zoo, Hina, and Kylie were the last to appear in the doorway and carefully made their way through the field of kids on the floor to come sit beside us.
"Okay," Cole said, clapping his hands together. "So, thank y'all for your ingenious planning and scheming. I reviewed everything, and I think we've landed on a winning strategy."
He walked back toward the whiteboards, picking up one of the markers. A blue line was drawn down the middle of the board. At the top of one half, he wrote Thurmond. On the other, Oasis.
Without any other preamble, he started in. "We're going to be making 2 hits. One, Oasis, is in Nevada. It'll serve as a kind of test run for our big hit on Thurmond in 5 weeks' time. In addition to getting those poor kids out, think of Oasis as an opportunity to work out the kinks in our strategy."
I crossed my legs and rested my elbows on my knees, hands gripped in front of me. Calm. Something in my mind clicked into place at the familiarity of this, being debriefed on an upcoming op. The other league kids, Vida included, appeared to feel the same way, leaning into the moment when everyone else seemed to edge back, unsure.
"One or 2 volunteers will enter Oasis ahead of the actual hit."
He turned to face the cluster of greens sitting together.
"We're going to need to install a small camera in the frames of someone's glasses, and it can relay back to us here. We need to get a sense of the compound's layout to fine-tune our timing."
"Why glasses?" Senator Cruz asked. "Won't those be taken when they're brought into the camp, too?"
"No, they're considered essential items," I piped up. "They're probably the only things that won't be taken."
If Liam recognized that that had been lifted from his original plans at East River, he didn't show it. He sat with his legs sprawled out in front of him, leaning back on his hands. He watched his brother with wariness.
The catch is, the kids who volunteer can't have been previously in a camp. PSF policy dictates that kids be returned to the original camp they were processed through, and Oasis is a relatively new camp. There is absolutely no pressure to participate. Like I said, this is purely volunteer.
Zoo glanced between Liam and Chubbs, but it was Vida who smoothed a tuft of her hair down in silent reassurance.
That aspect of the plan won't be necessary for Thurmond, as we have three people who have been inside of the camp and are intimately familiar with its layout. The other difference between this and the big hit is what we're doing with the kids we free. From what intel we have, otherwise known as what intel Clancy let us have, Oasis has approximately 50 kids, all of whom I'd like to have return with us. Depending on how willing they are to fight, we can ask them to join us in the Thurmond hit, or we can slowly return them back to their parents, a few kids at a time.
Are we still going to go out and try to round up the tribes of kids? Chubbs asked, jerking his thumb back toward the map.
Cole nodded.
We'll start sending out cars once we have supplies. We need as much manpower as possible if we're going to pull this off ourselves.
He moved through the other parts of the plan quickly. They were sketchy, at best, until we had actual images from inside of the camp's walls. It would be a small team, no more than 10 of us, armed but with the order to avoid a firefight if we could. With only 50 kids, there would be maybe 12 PSFs there at most, and one or two camp controllers. We would pose as a military convoy, bringing in the weekly supplies. I would be out in front, of course, because I'd have the job of influencing one of the camp controllers. He or she would continue to report that everything in the camp was fine while we drove the kids out using the camp's own transportation, whether it be SUVs, trucks, or a bus. The kids were silent, processing this, until Liam finally said,
50 kids is a hell of a lot different than 3,000 kids.
Better to run this through on a scaled model,
Cole said, smiling, but somehow not smiling.
Okay, that may be true, but other than giving us practice and rescuing a small group of kids, what is this going to accomplish?
Cole put his hands on his hips, one brow raised.
That's not enough for you? Really?
No, I mean...
Liam ran an agitated hand back through his hair.
The plan is good, but couldn't it serve as something else, too? Are we going to release the photos or video that's taken so people can actually see what conditions are like in there?
A few kids murmured in agreement, including Lucy, who added,
I like that idea a lot. People should have the opportunity to see what it's really like.
Do you have the means to do that without Gray tracing their source, swooping in and blowing this place sky high?
Liam's face was still hard, but I could sense him retreating under Cole's look.
Whose plan was this? Chubbs asked. I read through all of them, and I don't recognize it.
Cole's jaw set, just for a moment.
It's a combination of a number of them. I pulled the best elements from each.
Actually, it was the exact plan I had handed him, and he knew it. I faced the front of the room, refusing to turn when I felt Chubbs's gaze fall on me. There was no reason to fuel the fire by pointing it out to them.
Senator?
Cole motioned for her to step up.
Ah, yes,
she said. I was able to secure a promise of supplies from my contacts in Canada. Food, gasoline, technology, and a limited supply of guns. The issue is that they refuse to bring them across the border into California. They want to bring them in by boat to Gold Beach, Oregon.
Is that doable?
Liam spoke up before Cole did.
I just need a map and a car, both of which I can find around here. And at least three kids as backup.
Cole amended.
Kylie, Zach, and Vida.
And me.
The words were only just out of my mouth when there was a bang at the other end of the room.
I turned around in time to see Nico stumble backward and trip over the chair he'd been sitting in. He pressed both hands against his mouth as his knees gave out under him. The noise that escaped him was a high, keening moan. I was up and moving toward him before I could stop myself, gripping his arms to steady him and stop his rocking.
What? What is it?
By then, Cole and the rest of the room had already surrounded the laptop, blocking my view of whatever was on the screen.
Kate,
Nico cried.
Kate, Ruby, they took her. They took Kate.
Gasps flew up around me like a flock of birds. I released my grip on Nico and pushed to the front of the kids, who folded against each other to create a path for me. Vida was gripping the laptop, had lifted it off the desk, and it was only because Chubbs was there to grab her arms that she didn't get to slam it down against the hard surface.
"You son of a bitch!" she spat at Cole. "This is on you, asshole!"
"God damn it, damn it!"
Chubbs wrapped both arms over her chest, pinning her arms to her side as she lashed out with her feet, not caring who she kicked. She thrashed around, trying to headbutt him off, and only succeeded in knocking his glasses off his face. Zoo rushed to pick them up before they could be trampled. The video on the screen was looping on the homepage of a news site, fuzzy and shaky, as if it had been shot from a distance. A long line of men and women with black hoods and bound hands and legs were lying on the side of a highway with smoking car wreckage nearby. They were loaded onto the back of a military truck one at a time, overseen by soldiers armed with assault rifles that reflected the late afternoon light. The headline running beneath the pictures was, "Children's League Agents Captured in Colorado." My head throbbed as I watched it play through again, searching for her, trying to see what made Vida and Nico certain. Nearly all of the prisoners were dressed in black sweats or op gear, the same things they had left the ranch in. Some were easy enough to identify. Sen's long braid, Instructor Johnson's imposing height. Maybe she hadn't reached the other agents in time to try to turn them back. Maybe she was the one who had recorded the video and was safely on her way back to us. Maybe she... Cole paused the video on a shot of the prisoners lining up at the truck and pointed to a smaller figure at the end. I leaned forward, bringing my face close to the screen. When he moved his finger, I saw the traces of white blonde hair escaping from beneath the hood. The figure was standing calmly, despite the awkward angle at which they'd bound her arms. The other agents bucked and bumped the soldiers, hassling them even on their way into imprisonment. Cole unpaused the video, and she walked forward, head down, not so much as shrugging off the touch of the soldiers who lifted her into the back of the truck.
No.
I felt a painful crack down my center. The shapes and faces around me seemed to blur as I stepped back, wrapping my arms around myself. Blood pounded through my veins, making my legs feel light, my head lighter. I couldn't calm the sensation, couldn't get the jitters out of my nerves long enough to think a whole coherent thought.
Kate! She left. I let her go. They'll kill her. They'll execute her as a traitor. I let her go, and now they have her. They have Kate.
I heard Nico's crying and felt the pressure build behind my own eyes, a pain that spread to cover my whole face.
What does the AMP watermark mean? Liam was asking. It's in the upper right-hand corner of the video.
That's short for Amplify, Senator Cruz answered. They're an underground news outlet. Gray must be livid. They've shown he hasn't successfully stamped out the League in the Los Angeles attacks like he promised.
Do they collect information? How do they distribute it? Liam pressed. Do you have any contacts there?
Well, yes, but...
But it doesn't matter, Lee, Cole cut in. Look at this, Liam said, gesturing toward the laptop. They got the video to a major online news outlet. They convinced them to run it, knowing that Gray could come after this company, too. This is what we should be focused on, not fighting.
Kids were nodding now, whispering.
We don't need guns. We need to get people information.
information about camp locations, what the conditions are like there. Amplify could help us get the word out, and then the parents will want to do something to help the kids themselves. They'll go to the camps, stage protests.
Liam!
Cole barked. Pay attention to what's important here. News organizations cannot be trusted, no matter how underground they claim to be. They'll sell you out in a second if it means attaching their name to a good story. You want to know why I won't contact them? Because I don't want to risk the lives of everyone here by accidentally or intentionally revealing our location. We can do this ourselves. End of discussion. Liam stood his ground, color washing up from his throat to his face as his temper rose. Cole squared off against him, looking as furious as I'd ever seen him.
We have to go after them, Vida was saying. Where is the nearest prison bunker to where they were picked up? Would they fly them east?
They'd have to keep them alive. They'd want to interrogate them, right?
We can put our ear to the ground, stage an op.
We can't do that, Vida, and you know it, Cole said.
He leaned back against the desk, his arms crossed over his chest. Still, I saw how his hand gave a small jerk and how he pressed his arms closer to his body to try to hide it. His face was painted with fury, lined with sympathy. The words didn't make sense to me, not in the context of his expression.
What the fuck? Hey. You think I don't want to go after my friend? You think I want her to go through this? No one deserves this, least of all Kate. It's too late to do anything. You're right. They're probably going to try to bring them in for interrogation. But once they have them underground, they're gone. They've disappeared. We're not ever...
He swallowed.
We're not going to see any of those people alive again.
Vida let out a scream of frustration.
We got your ass out! We got you out of one of those prisons!
With a fully armed, well-trained tactical team, Cole said. And even then there were casualties. Even if we find where they've brought them, do you honestly think Kate could live with herself knowing that any of you were hurt trying to get her out? This is why we have that rule in the league. If you're caught, we can't come for you.
Yeah, unless it's you, she snarled.
Because Albin thought he might still have the flash drive of information from Lita, the one that was now worthless, because of what he really was. I looked over at him, silently willing him to just tell them so they'd understand.
You're always bragging about those crazy-ass missions you went on, she said, her voice taking on a pleading tone.
Vida slumped, her furious energy sapped to the point that Chubbs was holding her up on her feet.
Why not this one? Why?
Because this one wouldn't be crazy. It'd be suicidal, Cole said. And the fastest, best way we have of getting her and the others out is to see our plan through. It's to get Gray out of office.
Talk to Harry, Liam said. He has contacts in the different branches of the military. He can recommend someone to talk to.
Cole looked like he wanted to argue with that, like the idea of asking his stepfather for help repulsed him, but he held his tongue.
The bigger concern we have now is deciding whether to stay here or go. Any one of them could compromise our location. You said that your plan was to trick them into thinking we were going too, Chubb said, that we weren't coming here at all. Right.
Cole hesitated.
But Connor knew that we were staying.
Oh, fuck you! Vida yelled, finally breaking out of Chubbs's hold. Fuck you, Stuart! You think she'd give us up?
Having experienced their interrogation methods firsthand, darling, Cole said, his voice venomous, I would say that is an unfortunate possibility.
She won't.
The others turned to look at me, and I wondered if I looked as flushed and crazed as I felt. Kate would die before she'd tell them. And that was the problem, wasn't it? She would let them kill her. She would sacrifice herself before she'd ever let them hurt us. A scream bubbled up in my chest as Liam reached over, trying to wrap an arm around me.
I shrugged him off, pulling away from his touch. I didn't want to be near anyone right now. The room was suffocating, got smaller and smaller and smaller as more people turned to stare. I have to get out of here. Now. Right now, before the black swelling in my vision overtook everything. I couldn't get air into my chest, not with so many people around me. The air in the hallway was cool, at least. I wanted to go, just go, but I couldn't take the tunnel out, and I couldn't keep pacing the downstairs halls like an insane person. Without a thought, without remembering getting there, I was upstairs, pushing through the double doors separating the halls, and I was in the training room. I got on the nearest treadmill, blood rushing loud enough in my ears to drown out the electronic beeps as I turned up the speed and began to run. The levels flew by, and still I kept my finger on the up arrow until it felt like I was flying. My feet struck the belt in time with the bruising pace of my heart. She's gone. She's gone. She's gone, just like Jude. You told her to leave. You sent her away. They'll kill her. I lost time. I lost my head. I lost everything and ran. My arms pumped that much harder at my sides, as if they could keep dragging me forward when my legs started to give out. The air conditioning sent chills shooting down my back, cooling the sweat dripping from my face. I was only getting air to my lungs in long, harsh gasps, each breath sobbing in and out of me. There was a blur of black in the corner of my vision, a streak in front of my eyes. I pitched forward as the belt snapped to a stop under me, barely catching myself on the arms of the treadmill. Once my legs stopped moving, they seemed to dissolve under me. I couldn't put weight on my ankles, let alone straighten my knees. There were sounds to my right, murmurs that became words, words that finally took on meaning. I rolled onto my back, raising my hands to cover my face as I dragged in one breath after another. My hands were pulled away. A face swam in my vision. Blonde hair, square jaw, blue eyes. Liam.
Okay, easy does it. Come on, Jim. That's enough.
Cole. He caught me by the arms and forced me upright, sliding me forward to sit up at the edge of the machine. Sweat stung my eyes, tasted like salt on my lips. I told her to leave, I said hoarsely. It's my fault.
It's not your fault,
he said softly. He pushed the hair sticking to my forehead out of the way.
She made the choice to leave. She was doing what she thought was right, just like you and me.
I can't lose her, too, I told him.
I know, he said. She'll make it, though. You're right. She won't give us up. Of course she won't. Connor is smart. She'll figure out a way to survive and get back to her kids. That's how she is.
She and Jude, and who else? Who else would I have to lose before this was over?
Kansas HQ is probably already on this, he said quietly. We don't have the means to go get her, but they do. It's a lot of agents to lose, and good ones at that. I'll see if I can find out if they have something planned.
He turned us slightly to the right, reorienting my line of sight toward the door, where there were at least 10 kids watching his progress, varying degrees of worry on their faces. I tried to take a step, but now that my muscles were still, it was like they had seized up.
You gotta stand up and walk, Jim,
he said quietly, turning his back on them.
You have to walk out of here. Not just for them, but for yourself. Come on. You have to walk out of here on your own 2 feet.
So I did. Each step made my feet scream in pain where they rubbed up against the edge of the tennis shoes. I looked down to where bright red stains were spreading across the white cotton socks. I kept my hand on Cole's shoulder, trying to hide how heavily I was leaning on him, as we made a left down the hall instead of heading right to go downstairs where the bunk rooms were. I didn't have the energy to protest as he opened the door to Kate's old room and turned the lights on.
I managed to stay vertical until the small bed was in arm's reach. By then, my knees had had enough. Leaning forward, I tried to untie the shoelaces, but my hands were shaking so badly, Cole had to tease the knots out for me. He clucked his tongue at the sight of the socks as I peeled them off, but said nothing.
"I ruined it, didn't I?"
I asked. "The other kids won't trust me." Cole shook his head.
"All they saw was someone upset over losing someone they love. No harm, no foul, as the saying goes. Will you cut yourself some slack before you literally run yourself into the ground? Take care of yourself so you can help me take care of them, all right? That's the deal, and it starts tonight, right now, with you staying here and sleeping for at least 7 hours."
"But, Clancy..."
"I can deliver the little prince's meal for one night," he said. "Do you honestly think you could handle him right now if he tried to take you on?"
"Take someone with you," I said. "Have them watch from behind the door to make sure he doesn't try anything."
"I'll ask Vida."
"Chubbs would be better."
"You got it."
I spread my legs out on the bed in front of me as he stood up, too tired to argue, too tired to do much beside watch him go. Just as he turned out the lights, I said, "Tomorrow. I'm going to find Lillian Gray tomorrow. I'm going to take care of it. Of everyone. And when this was over, I'd be the one to go find Kate. I'd save her the same way she saved me."
"Atta girl. I have no doubt."
He stopped in the doorway, turning back.
"There's someone waiting for you. Do you want me to let her in?"
I nodded. It was Zoo. Cole shut the door behind him, and I could just make out the edges of her dark shape, outlined by the faint glow bleeding into the room from under the door. She pulled the thin top sheet up over me, finishing with a kiss to my forehead. And that. Not the video, not imagining what they would do to Kate as a prisoner. That tender kiss was what brought the tears to the surface. "I'm sorry," I whispered. "I didn't mean to make you worry." "She took care of me, and I never treated her as well as I should have, and now she's gone and doesn't know that I'm sorry. They could kill her." I felt her hand around mine, squeezing in reassurance.
I know.
She used her other hand to smooth the hair away from my face. "You lost someone," I said, my voice sounding rough to my own ears.
"The guy who helped you get to California.
Will you tell me about him? Not what happened to him, not if you don't want to talk about it, but what he was like as a person. Would that be okay?" My eyes had adjusted to the darkness well enough to see her nod, even if I couldn't read her expression. "What was his name?" Zoo picked up the same small notebook she'd been toting around for weeks. I closed my eyes, listening to the faint scratch of her pencil against the paper, only opening them when she tapped my shoulder with it. She reached over and switched on the light on the dresser so I could read it. "Gabe." In the single second before she turned the light off, I saw tears caught in her lashes. The expression on her face knifed clean through my heart. I would have done anything, anything, to take the weight of that pain off her shoulders before it crushed her into dust. But I knew better. There was no real relief from it. You just had to be willing to let the people around you serve as supports and take their share of it when it seemed too much, too heavy, to hold on your own. I shifted back on the narrow mattress, giving her room to crawl in next to me. Zoo was all elbows and knees, growing, stretching up in height, the way everyone seemed to, right before they crossed that strange, ambiguous line into being a teenager, an almost adult. But the way she cried, the way she wrapped her arms around me and buried her warm, wet face against my neck, that was a kid. That was a kid who'd already lived a hard life and was being asked to take on more. "I know," I said quietly. "I know." The darkness rose and fell over me like a cold wave.
I shut my eyes, relishing the simple fact that my mind was like a blank sheet, drained of all thoughts. But hours later, no matter how still I forced myself to be, I couldn't shake the rush of sensation in my legs, the feeling that they were still running. 11. I woke up the next morning looking for a fight. Muscles ached that I didn't know I had, and my feet screamed bloody murder when I slid my tennis shoes back on. All the sleep had done was process my stifling sadness into pure, unflinching anger. I had energy to burn. I opened the door and shut it behind me as quietly as I could, so as not to wake up Zoo. The manual clock in the hallway said 4:45 a.m. It would be another hour before anyone else was up and ready for the day. Plenty of time to work out the lightning zipping through my body and return to some state of calm. The light in the gym was already on, and my whole body tensed in anticipation when I saw who was running on the treadmill, taking quick, confident strides. Cole must have seen me out of the corner of his eye, but he kept running and didn't acknowledge me until I was standing right next to the machine and its whirring belt.
"Not in the mood, Jim."
His voice was flat, edged with warning. "Too bad," I said, walking over to retrieve two pairs of gloves.
"I am."
I waited for him, gloves on my hands, stretching, trying to warm my body up for this. Finally, after a good 5 minutes, he let out a grunt and hit the stop button on the machine. Cole scooped up the gloves from the floor, his face flushed from the run, his eyes overly bright. I had half a second to drop back into a fighting stance before his knee rose up toward my stomach. I jumped back, but was caught by yet another obvious swing he made to my sternum. That, at least, sent the thoughts shooting out of me, along with every last ounce of air in my lungs. It was a distraction. He had me pinned against his chest in the space of a single heartbeat. I twisted out from under his arm, trying to use the momentum to flip him over onto his back. Like that was ever going to happen. The best I got was a stomp to his instep. He didn't back off, though, not the way he normally would have. I felt the temperature in the room spike dramatically, and then he pulled back, letting me drop onto the floor with a sound of disgust. "No!" The word shot through my mind as he turned his back to me and started to remove his gloves. The sparring may have started as a way to release some of the heat that was boiling me alive from the inside out, but my head had hooked into the rush of it in a way I hadn't expected. I needed more. I needed to get the black thoughts of Kate and Jude and what was waiting for us at the end of all of this out of me, and that required sweating or bleeding it out. I lowered my head and charged toward him. I saw his expression darken in the mirror in front of him just before he slammed into it. This time, momentum actually did its job, sending us both sprawling back onto the edge of the mat. Without a single word, Cole dragged me by my neck further onto the mat, and then he showed me just how pissed off he really was. Trying to roll or kick him off did nothing. He had me pinned beneath him, his whole crushing weight settled on my chest. One hand pinned mine over my head, and the other arm came across my neck, applying just the right amount of pressure there to dwindle my oxygen supply down to nothing. He eased up on my windpipe, but not by much. I thrashed under him, knees kicking up to try to hit his lower back. His skin seemed tight against his skull, his face set with fury. I choked in a shallow breath, but he didn't pull back. My mind was floating away from my body, drifting into that same pool of black forming in my eyes.
"Cole!"
I choked out.
"Stop!"
He didn't hear me. Wherever he'd gone inside, I wasn't going to be able to touch him, and I knew that the only way out of this was in. I drove into his mind like I was throwing a punch. I should have landed the hit and bounced back out, let it register like an electrical shock to his system. But his thoughts had hooks. They caught my mind, dragging it back down, drowning me in the scene melting into place around me. Light swirled around me, bending into shadows that became a small kitchen paneled in dark wood. There was dim, warm light coming through the curtains that masked the window above the sink. I smelled something burning. Food. The trail of gray floating around me was smoke drifting from the closed oven door. Pots and pans popped up on the stove, appearing one at a time. The faint sizzling sound came from the brown sauce that had boiled over the lip of the metal pan. A woman appeared in front of me, wearing a simple blue dress. I had a low vantage point from the floor. I couldn't see anything besides her long blonde hair and the hands that kept pushing me back, back, back. A surge of anger flooded me, and I saw, rather than felt, my own arms up, straining to reach for something. For the man was the last to materialize, facing the woman. His face was in shadows, but there was something familiar about it. The shape of the nose, the set of the jaw. I knew this face. I'd seen two younger versions of it. He had gone a shade past red and was screaming, screaming, sweat and fury pouring off him, clouding the room, making everything feel slow and heavy. My gaze shifted down, taking in his dark, wrinkled polo shirt, the squirming toddler he held like a sack in one arm, slowly going pink in the face as he cried, trying to wriggle free, reaching for my arms. His hair was lighter, curling at the ends. The first sound that broke through the muffled din of the memory was his piercing wail of terror as the man picked up the steaming iron from the board and brought it up near his face, as if he was going to press its tip against the baby's cheek. The woman in front of me fell onto her knees, begging.
Put him down, please. I'll fix it. I'll fix it. It'll be all right. Don't you know? I love you. I won't have anyone over again. I promise. Just please give him to me. Please give him to me.
The iron was lowered, set back down on the board, singeing the shirt left there waiting to be smoothed out. The man's expression transformed, a sickening look of triumph crossing it as he shifted the sobbing boy, holding him under his other arm. He reached out to touch the woman, to stroke her face. The man was so fixated on her bowed head that he didn't see the skillet she'd pulled off a nearby low shelf, not until she stood and swung it up in a clean arc toward his face. The baby fell to the floor, and I rushed toward him, the sound of gurgling and pain and metal striking flesh and bone drowned out by his hysterical tears. I turned his soft weight over and picked him up. There was a cut at the corner of his lips where one of his new teeth had caught the tender skin. It was bleeding profusely, but the boy stilled and quieted, looking up into my face with these wide eyes rimmed with big tears. His thumb slid into his mouth as I tried to wipe the blood away. He didn't start bawling again until he saw the woman, his mother, crying too, reaching down to pick him up and clutch him to her chest. She snatched up my hand and dragged me away from the man's prone form on the floor, the mess of his blood on the black and white checkered tile. He shuddered and coughed, and we only moved faster, toward the door. She swiped her purse off the counter, then doubled back for the keys when she realized they'd fallen out. The door led to a garage, and the light that flooded the cramped, dark space dissolved the memory once and for all. I surfaced at the exact moment the weight came off my chest. I was breathing, coughing, choking on the flood of air that filled it. I rolled onto my side, curling into as small a protective ball as I could. It was several agonizing minutes before fear released its claws from me. The small, breathy sobs I heard weren't my own. I propped myself up on my elbow, looking for the source. Cole sat at the edge of the mat, his back to me as he hunched over his knees, struggling to master his breathing. The section of the mirror in front of him was a spiderweb of cracks, stained with blood. I forced my feet under me and stood on shaking legs, taking one halting step toward him and then another. He clutched his right hand to his chest, ignoring the way it bled onto his shirt. I walked to the towel rack and returned with a small cloth, pulling his hand toward me so I could clean the blood away. His skin was hot, boiling to the touch as he shook.
Fuck,
he breathed out.
I'm sorry. We shouldn't do this anymore. Fuck!
Okay, I said softly, and stayed anyway. I was in the bathroom, still dripping from my shower, when I heard Chubbs's voice carry down the hallway. With one last glance to make sure my hoodie covered the worst of the new bruising on my neck, I dashed out of the room, calling after him. He spun on his heel, clearly relieved.
There you are. You missed the others. They had to leave. Apparently it's an 8-hour drive to Gold Beach, and the idiots want to do it in one day.
They found a truck to carry the supplies? I asked.
Yeah, which you would have discovered for yourself had you made an appearance at breakfast. Sorry. That came out wrong. I didn't get to tell you last night. But I'm sorry about Agent Connor. I want to tell you everything will be all right, but I'm afraid you'll punch me.
It was the first faint smile I'd managed all day. Was Vi okay about going? He let out a long sigh, deflating somewhat.
She was trying to find you last night to run ideas by you. But it's probably for the best she didn't. She had a million ideas of how the two of you could sneak off to find Agent Connor.
There it was, the now daily sensation of being the biggest asshole in the world. I hadn't even tried to talk to her about this last night. I'd promised her that we would talk about these things, work through them together, and what had I done? Gone off alone to run my head clear.
Are we still going to talk to Clancy?
He asked. Wait, how did you... I didn't remember mentioning it to him, but it was exactly why I'd come out to catch him.
We talked about this yesterday afternoon, when you were going to lie down for a while, he said.
I gave him a look that must have registered how blank my mind felt. We did?
We did. For at least 10 minutes. You nodded? That's generally a sign that you, you know, understand and agree.
Oh, you're right. Sorry.
You are exhausted, he said, poking my forehead. Impaired judgment and forgetfulness are both symptoms.
I nodded, giving him that. Do you mind coming now? I have a feeling this might take a while.
And miss the chance to spend another day hauling around filthy, broken crap? Lead on.
Cole hadn't had the thought, or likely the time, to prepare Clancy's meals for the day. I listened to Chubbs complain about Vida and Vida's language and how Vida's reckless history with firearms was going to get us all killed, as I did my best not to take Clancy's water bottle, dump it out, and fill it with bleach. The pantry had been nothing but bones a week ago, but the humanitarian rations had managed to flesh it out to the point that it was starting to look like a healthy stash. I glanced at the clipboard posted outside of its door, feeling a faint smile stretch across my lips at Liam's neat, careful notes about what we'd already used and what was on the menu for the rest of the week. Food allergies were noted at the very bottom of the chart. Of course. Leave it to Liam to be thoughtful enough to kill himself to try to find almond milk and gluten-free pasta for the two whole kids that needed it.
Ready?
Chubbs asked once we were standing in the file room. I punched in the code, bringing him into the small hallway that connected it to the cells. The door at the other end of the hall had a small window he could observe us through. You have to stay here the whole time, I said. You can't come in. I know you think he can't affect you, but I'd rather not test the theory.
Hell no, I'm not coming in. If he takes over your head, I'm going to lock you both in there together and go get help.
He shot me a sharp look.
That's not allowed to happen. Make sure you don't put me in that position.
I nodded. One more thing. No matter what happens, I don't want you giving Liam specifics of what I'm going to do, good or bad. Promise me.
What exactly are you planning on doing? Using your body to get him to talk instead of your... Wow, I can't even finish that sentence. My brain is already trying to purge it.
My fingers tightened around the sack of food. Nothing like that. I'd just rather not have this serve as a reminder of how far I can go.
Ruby.
I pushed by him, stepping through the door and shutting it firmly behind me. I glanced back over my shoulder and met his gaze through the glass. Then he stepped back, just out of my line of sight.
"Taking time out of your busy schedule of sitting around doing nothing to come for a quick visit? I'm honored."
Clancy sat in the middle of his cot, reading, back against the wall. Blanket and pillow were neatly stowed beside him, both requests previously granted by Cole in the vain, stupid hope it might butter the kid up to be more loose-lipped. As I opened the door's flap to throw his brown bag meals in, Clancy flipped to the next page in his book, marked it, and set the book down on top of the pillow. He might as well have thrown the copy of Watership down at my face.
"Oh,"
he said, all innocence.
"Have you read it? Stuart brought it in for me since I've been such a good boy. I was hoping for war and peace, but beggars can't be choosers, etc., etc."
It was an old edition of the book. The cover was wrinkled by mistreatment, and there were ancient-looking library stickers on its spine. The pages had yellowed, curved under too many rough grips. But I had a feeling if I brought it up to my nose, it would have that scent, that one indescribable fragrance that no amount of cleaning could ever scrub from libraries and bookstores. A few more books had been stacked neatly beneath the cot, battered copies of To Kill a Mockingbird, Sons and Lovers, a book called A Farewell to Arms, and a copy of a blue book, Tiffany's Table Manners for Teenagers, that had been torn to shreds and tossed across the cell. Typical Cole. I wondered who he'd picked to watch his back last night.
"What did you give him for it?"
"Some crumbs of information he was desperate for."
Clancy glanced inside the bag as he sauntered back over to his cot. He combed his dark hair back off his forehead, grabbing the book again.
"It's only by virtue of everyone's sheer stupidity here that they haven't figured out what he is. He telegraphs it so obviously, gets so pathetic when he asks about them."
"Why that book?" I interrupted, well aware that Chubbs was listening. My mind was jumping from memory to memory, trying to remember when I had told him about loving the book. The way he was holding it, pressed against his chest, made me want to go in there and rip it out of his hands before he tainted that, too.
"I remembered you mentioned it at East River,"
he said, sensing the unasked questions.
"You said it was your favorite book."
"Funny, I don't remember it ever coming up." Clancy returned my tight-lipped smile.
"Must have been one of our more private conversations then."
Private conversations. That's how he rationalized all of those invasive lessons when I let my guard down and let him inside my mind, all on the grounds of him trying to teach me how to control my abilities.
"Your people cannot rule the world, for I will not have it so. All the world will be your enemy, prince with a thousand enemies,"
he read.
"And whenever they catch you, they will kill you. But first they must catch you, digger, listener, runner, prince with a swift warning. Be cunning and full of tricks, and your people shall never be destroyed."
He snapped the book shut and leaned back against the wall.
"Never thought I'd find a story about rabbits fascinating, but even they have their appeal, apparently."
"Do you even understand what you just read?" I asked, angry all over again. In the story, the lines had been spoken by Lord Frith, the rabbit's god. He was addressing El Arira, a prince of his kind, who'd let his warren's population spiral out of control, too proud of their strength. In retaliation for his arrogance, Lord Frith turned the other animals of the forest into the rabbit's enemies and natural predators. But, at the same moment, he had gifted them with the traits and skills they'd need to have a fighting chance of survival. Leave it to Clancy to mentally cast himself as the hero in every story.
"I do, though I think I prefer this one to make my point. A rabbit who does not know when a gift has made him safe is poorer than a slug, even though he may think otherwise himself."
I shook my head.
"Stop.
Just stop. This is low, even for you.
Oh, believe me, this isn't even close to how low I'm willing to sink to get you to understand what I've been trying to tell you.
The issue isn't that I don't understand. It's that I don't agree.
I know, he said. God, do I know that. There have been so many times I wished you could, that you hadn't let them crush you the way they did at Thurmond. You're so unkind to yourself, and you can't even differentiate the actual truth from the warped version of it that they fed to you.
I was so sick of these speeches that if I hadn't come in here with a purpose, I would have left before he could get started. But this was my price of admission. I had to listen to his bullshit excuses for why he treated everyone around him with as much thought as the grass beneath his shoes.
Never once, in the whole time I've known you, have you ever referred to what we can do as a gift. You snarl and snap your teeth if the word gifted is so much as whispered in your direction. There's a stubbornness in you I just don't understand, no matter how much thought I put toward it. I can't imagine how exhausting it must be to use your, what do you call them? Abilities. You punish yourself if you fail to control them, and you punish yourself if you succeed. One of the things I find most fascinating about you is that you're somehow able to mentally separate your gift from yourself, like it's a whole separate entity that you can beat back into submission.
He stood up and came toward me, his arms crossed over his chest in a mirror of my pose. The air conditioning clicked on overhead, breathing out a hiss of cold air. The chill stroked its icy fingers over my bare arms, my neck, my cheeks. It was a caress. For a moment, I was sure I was standing somewhere else, the smell of evergreen and spice filling my nose.
Stop it!
I didn't know how he was doing it, but I wasn't the same Ruby I'd been at East River. I wasn't blind to his tricks. This is how he consistently wormed his way into my head, by unsettling me. His eyebrows rose.
I'm not doing anything.
I let out a small noise of disgust and made a show of starting to turn back toward the door, testing how desperate he was for me to stay. How hard it would be to play this little plan of mine out.
Don't you wonder why it's so easy for blues to control what they can do?
He called.
It's because each time they move something, it's a natural manifestation of their will, something they want to happen. It never turns off for the greens, because their gift is like a net over their minds. They see it as their mind working, and nothing more.
Whereas for someone like Zoo, a yellow, or me, or even Cole, we had to know we could turn it off, and completely, otherwise we'd destroy everything and everyone around us. We used our minds like weapons clenched tightly in our fists, struggling to return them back to their holsters without injuring ourselves in the process.
It must be torture for you to be around those three blues constantly, to have them tell you everything will be all right and that you can control what you do, and then see them lift a finger and have it work perfectly. You spent 6 years at Thurmond, scared to so much as breathe the wrong way in case it made them give you a second look. You know what they'll do if they ever catch you and bring you back to that camp. They'll keep you there long enough to run their tests and confirm what they already know. You saw how quickly and quietly they took the reds, oranges, and yellows out. The reds, they went to Project Jamboree. The yellows to one of the new camps built specifically to keep their abilities at bay. But what happened to the oranges? Where did those kids go?
My throat had closed up on itself. What little courage I had left was draining out of me as fast as the familiar dread was rolling in.
Do you want me to tell you?
He asked, his voice quiet as he leaned his shoulder against the glass. I surprised myself with a breathless, yes.
Some of them went to Lita's research program,
The one that Nico and I were brought into after they closed the first one at Thurmond, Clancy said. The others, if you believe the word of some of the PSFs stationed there at the time, are 2 miles north of the camp, buried a few hundred feet away from the railroad tracks.
Why? Why kill them? Why waste their lives? Why do it like they were animals that needed to be put down? Why? Why them?
Because they couldn't be controlled. Period. It was the neatest, easiest solution to their headache, and because they also knew if the kids were to ever be released from the camps, they could explain it simply by saying that IAAN was the root of it, that they were susceptible to a non-existent second wave of the disease. Our gift manifests in few enough kids that it won't raise many, if any, red flags. The birth rate was low enough these days. Few people would take the risk of a child being claimed by IAAN, that it seemed impossible to guess. His dark eyes slid toward me.
I've seen the military orders, the explanations for how to do it humanely, so the child only registers the smallest amount of pain. I've never been able to reach any of them in time to save them.
You don't save anyone, I said bitterly. You only help yourself.
Listen to me,
he snapped, striking a palm against the glass.
You are your abilities and they are you. I can't put it to you more plainly. Do you know why I hate this cure? It's a statement that what we are is inherently wrong. It's a punishment for something that isn't our fault, all because they can't control their fear about what we can do, any more than they can control their resentment that there are people out there stronger and more powerful than they are. They want to strip you of yourself, your ability to protect and enforce your right to make decisions about your life, your own body. Mark my words. In the end, it won't be a choice. They'll decide this for you.
The cure is not a punishment if it saves the lives of the kids born after us. They should never have to experience what we went through. Did you ever stop and think about them before you tried to burn the research?
Of course I did. But this cure you keep talking about, it's not a cure. It's a painful, invasive procedure that only helps the kids who have gone through the change. It doesn't do a damn thing for the others who were never going to survive.
Try again, I said. I've gotten much better at detecting your bullshit. He ran an angry hand back through his dark hair in frustration.
You need to be focusing your energy on finding out the cause. It isn't a virus, that much Lita figured out. It has to be something in the environment, something that was tainted.
Whether or not he realized it now, he'd walked right into the trap I'd hoped he would. I needed him to be talking and thinking about the cure. It would naturally lead to thoughts of his mother, what he had done to her, where we could find her.
Now isn't the time to change yourself, to fit into the world, Clancy said, his voice raw with whatever thoughts were storming beneath his skin. You should be changing the world to accept you. To let you exist as you are without being cut open and damaged.
This was it. I felt the opening in the conversation as though the air had parted around us. He'd always been able to get what he wanted out of me by plucking and plucking and plucking at painful memories until I was too distraught or emotional to ward his advances off. I knew he was capable of losing his temper. I'd seen it too many times to think it was a rare occurrence. But I didn't want anger. I wanted anguish, the kind I had seen on Nico's face the instant he opened the photo of his younger self. When he reconnected with what they had done to him, Clancy would be as malleable as wet sand in my hands.
If everything you say is true, that the cure is cruel and will change us, prove it.
That brought him up short.
How?
Show me. Prove it to me that it's as terrible as you say. I have absolutely zero reason to take your word for it, considering your stellar record of telling the truth. The look of hope on his face turned sour.
Years of research and information isn't enough for you. I already gave you everything I had.
Yes, on Thurmond. On the leader research program. Not about this.
Ah.
Clancy began to pace, running his fingers along the glass wall separating us.
So you want to see for yourself. If you can't take my word, how can you trust my memory? Even those can be faked, as you yourself know.
I can tell the difference, I said, realizing with a shock of awareness that I actually could. The memory from the other day. The one he'd used to show me how to log into his server and pull all of those files. It had felt different because it was different. It was pure imagination on his part. That was why I'd been able to step into it, interact as myself with what was happening, rather than reenact what had happened as the person I was reading. There'd been a different texture to the whole experience.
You did figure it out. Well done.
Clancy sounded pleased.
Memory and imagination are two different beasts, processed and handled in different ways by the mind. All of those times you replaced someone's memories, planted an idea in their head, you didn't realize you were doing several different things at once, did you?
Was I? Until now, I'd taken everything I could do in stride, done what had felt natural. Maybe it was pointless, because hopefully I'd one day be rid of them and the terror they held for me, but shouldn't I at least make more of an effort to understand exactly what I was doing and how?
You're stalling, I reminded him. No, just waiting for you,
he said quietly.
If you want to see it, if this is the only way to prove it to you, then it's fine.
I tested his defenses with a brush of my mind against his, but he was waiting. And the moment I closed my eyes and tried to touch his mind with mine, it was like he'd reached out a hand to guide me in. I was pulled through the gauzy layers of stained memories, catching a face here, a sound there. Clancy possessed a highly organized mind. It was like running down a winding hallway of windows, each offering a tantalizing look inside. Or walking down the aisle of a library, searching for the right book, and only glimpsing the other titles as you quickly passed. The images began to smear, dripping down like ink on a wet page. The colors morphed and merged, and then, with the force of a blow to the chest, settled. I was thrown into a memory so solid I could feel the cold metal table biting at my already stiff skin. Blinking several times to clear the halo of light around my vision, I felt myself try to strain up, only to be jerked back down by the black straps pinning my wrists and ankles. There were no layers of fabric covering me, not even a blanket, only wires and electrodes exploding out of my head and chest like a bursting cocoon. The men and women in white coats swarmed the table I'd been laid out on, their voices buzzing around my head. They pulled wires off my skull, replaced them with new ones, touched everywhere. Everywhere. Forced my eyelids open roughly to shine a blinding light there. I could hear their quiet jokes and murmurs, see the outlines of their smiles behind their paper masks. He had shown me a memory like this once, back when we were at East River. It had been horrifying to watch, even more so to realize that it was taking place in a part of the infirmary I recognized by sight. But the simple truth was, the stronger the memory, the stronger the feelings associated with it, the clearer everything became. I knew now that when I heard something, smelled something, felt something in a memory, it was because it had been burnt so deeply into that person's mind, it had left a scar. This wasn't a memory about the cure research. That had been under his mother's control, far away from him. This is what they had done at Thurmond, before he'd been able to get himself out. They were studying him like a specimen, the way they had studied that red. Nico. A plastic mask was lowered onto my face, and sickly sweet air came flooding into my lungs. The overload of sensation dampened at the first touch of drugs to my system.
He'd told me once that they kept the kids sedated but awake during procedures so the machines could better monitor their normal brain functions and map the way the psi abilities rippled through them. Thurman's blue tiles echoed the machine's screeching, making it sound like they were everywhere, all of them drawing in closer, waiting for their turn. I couldn't swallow around my dry, heavy tongue. Saliva dripped past cracked, swollen lips into the muzzle they'd secured over my head. The jolt of fire came without warning, zigzagging down my spinal column, a ripping sensation that left me breathless with pain. It was like a static shock had been cranked up to 1,000 levels higher. I couldn't control myself as my body seized up, relaxed, seized, relaxed.
"Try it again, this time!"
A stocky researcher let out a cry of disgust, jumping back from the table. The stench of bleach was replaced by piss and blood and burnt flesh. I would have emptied my stomach, too, if there'd been anything in it. In that moment, I would have given anything to have choked on my own vomit and died. Humiliation seared through me as one of the researchers waved a nurse over to clean me up so they could start again.
"I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. All of you."
The words were lost as my brain was overloaded with a crackling sheet of pure, burning white. My gaze dropped from the U-shaped fluorescent light over me before its glow overtook the room and blinded me completely. I was surrounded by white coats and clipboards again, the clatter of metal instruments against metal trays, the goddamn beep, beep, beep of a heartbeat that wouldn't give out. The woman in front of me stepped to the side, flicking something on, music, the Beatles, singing, "I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand." Their bright voices perfectly in sync with the cheerful music. One researcher began to sing along, off-key, as another bolt of white, hot lightning tore through my skull. When my vision cleared, the black at the edges retreating, my body was still throbbing, but it was dark around me, sweetly dark, and the surface under me was cloth, not steel. Done.
"We'll give a good report of progress.
Carefully adjusting treatment. In good hands. Treatment working." The stocky, balding doctor shook hands with a man in a jacket. What color was that? Not blue. Not blue. Panic rose up, gripping my brain as it grasped for the word. The man in the jacket pulled his mask away.
"I see beard. I see nose. All familiar. Head hurts. No name, only face. Face next to father. Phone. Report. Report me to him. Help. 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 Lift hand. Lift hand. Trying. No go. Not without me."
Words broke and crumbled in my mind, leaving sounds, letters.
Tongue stuck. Arm stuck. Pain burning. Everything burning.
A small shape appeared. The cot next to mine groaned. He came forward now. It was safe.
"Nico. Nico. Help."
A cold cloth on my face, cleaning. My hands, neck.
"Careful. Careful, Nico."
Aching head. Soft touches. Soft fingertips.
"Nice."
I was lifted, arms put into sleeves, shirt down over my head. Held.
"Warm heart."
Dark eyes burning.
"Safe."
"It's okay. I'm here." Cup to lips.
"Water."
Metal to lips. "Not fork. Not fork. What is... spoon. Spoon. Sweet. Meal.
Nico. Nicolas."
Crying.
"Warm. Nico."
Crying.
12. I ripped myself out of the memory, shoving against it. The exit was worse than the entry. I couldn't tell which direction I was going, couldn't navigate. Forward meant seeing that horrible moment again, Nico's shaved head and gaunt body, the heart-wrenching expression I recognized on his face. I didn't want to see it again, but I couldn't escape it, the simple truth. So I went the other way, only to find it was like passing through a field of barbed wire backward. No matter which way I tried to pull out of the memory, I was cut up. I was in pain. When I came to, safely back inside of my own mind, I was on my knees, my forehead resting against the glass. I gulped down one breath after another.
"Was that enough for you?"
Clancy snarled. His skin had taken on a clammy quality, and he was trembling, shaking almost.
"Are you satisfied?"
I don't know how I did it. I just disconnected my mind from everything I'd seen, scrubbed every ounce of feeling from my voice.
"No."
He wheeled back around.
"I already knew what the Thurmond testing was like."
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I felt like I was going to throw up all over again. What they'd done to his mind, even temporarily?
"You're supposed to be proving to me the cure itself is cruel." "She adapted the cure from that research. From the shocks."
"You think I don't know what you're really trying to do?" he said.
"That I'd be stupid enough to show you the actual cure procedure or where my mother is?"
"He knows. He knows where she is." He stalked over to his cot. There was enough of a link still left between our minds for me to be momentarily stunned by the resentment billowing through him. He needed to stop. I wanted him to stop. I stilled completely and reached deep into his mind, letting the intention steer me past his memories altogether into the part of his mind that was sparking with heat and drive. He froze, muscles, limbs, expression like stone. Clancy didn't move until I did, and then it was only as a mirror of my actions. It was like plucking strings. Each touch against this part of his mind produced a different response in him. I arranged him like I would an action figure, ignoring the pressure of his own mind trying to fight me off. This is it. This is what he felt each time he played with one of us, lightheaded, dizzy with the possibilities. I wasn't where I needed to be, not really. Somehow I needed to redirect myself back into his memories, only I didn't know how to remove myself from this part of his mind. It was dark and gripping.
"Mirror."
The word sprang into my ears. Clancy's voice, assertive, forcing me to listen. He knew I couldn't get out on my own, and he must have been afraid of what damage I could do inside him if he was actively trying to help me.
"Mirror minds."
I understood. My own thoughts shifted. I squeezed my eyes shut, hands clenched at my sides, as I forced the memory of me walking into the room to rise to the surface. I pulled free from the dark, feeling every bit like I was being physically dragged back by the hair. I was in the hallway again, watching as one by one the windows into his memories were slammed shut. I only had a second, just one, before he recovered.
"Lillian," I said.
"Mother." The trick worked the way it always had. Hearing the words redirected his thoughts, drawing up the one memory he'd been thinking of most recently, the one he wanted to protect. I knew what I was looking for, having seen a glimpse of the memory before. At the first appearance of the beautiful woman, her face framed by blonde hair, a plea on her lips, I dove in, driving harder than I ever had before. Lillian Gray's lab took shape around me, objects clicking into place like a puzzle. She'd tried to trick her son in order to bring him in to perform the procedure. She'd leaked her location in Georgia, knowing he'd be able to find her, and he did. I tugged harder on the image, forcing it to pass faster. Her hands were up, pacifying, the words, "Calm down, it's going to be okay," tumbling out of her.
I remembered the splatter of blood on the lapel of her white lab coat, how she'd ended up begging, "Clancy, no! Please, Clancy!" from the floor as he set the world around her on fire, trashed her machines. What I hadn't seen was the way he gripped her neck between his hands. I could actually feel her racing pulse beneath my fingers at the slightest pressure. Oh, God, he was going to... But instead, my hands drifted up, gripping either side of her face. There were no words to describe what I saw next. Reading a mind within a mind, an explosion of memories within a memory. The heat at my back was unbearable, but I was working, holding her still as I twisted, bent, broke every thought the woman had. A gunshot broke the connection, pain tearing across my right shoulder. I turned away from the woman's blank face, letting her crumple to the floor as two dark figures burst through the door. The glass around her caught the winking light of the fire. The strange, entrancing beauty of it was the last thing I remembered before I ran. I was thrown out of his head so hard that I fell back, cracking my skull against the wall behind me. Clancy was on the floor, as far away from me as he could get. His face was turned into the wall, his whole body heaving for breath. The cot was on its side, a barrier between us.
"Get out,"
he snarled.
"Get out!"
This time, I ran. My hands fumbled with the first lock, Clancy screaming those two words at me the whole time. The door opened from the other side, and I collided with the person there, struggling to get out of their grip as the door was kicked shut behind me.
"It's me. It's just me."
Chubbs hauled me down the short hall into the old file closet. I clung to his arm, my mind a mess of thoughts and feelings that weren't even mine. My legs gave out before we were in the hall. He jammed the key into the lock and turned it, stopping only long enough to rattle it once to make sure it was secure.
"Ruby,"
he said, his face splitting into two, three, four. We walked briskly toward the end of the hallway, me leaning on him the whole time, trembling with the effort it took to stay vertical. He opened one of the bunk room doors and pulled me inside. I slid down the nearest wall, trying to purge the sound of Clancy's voice with each exhale. Chubbs crouched down in front of me, watching me intently. How much of that had he heard? How much of what he'd seen had he actually understood? "You out-Clancy'd Clancy." I never even thought there was a chance I could do that with my abilities. To beat him? I'd managed to become him. And even with all of my promises to do whatever it took to find out about Lillian, I'd somehow never imagined this, that I was capable of it. Don't think about it. I had what I'd come for. I got the confirmation I needed. "She's still with the League," I said before he could ask me the question I saw in his face. "They came and took her away at the end."
"The First Lady. He definitely didn't kill her then?"
I shook my head. "He did something much worse." By the time I went looking for him, Cole was already gone. Senator Cruz delivered the news when I passed her in the upper-level hallway. "He went to meet with a friend who's still associated with the League to see if they have information about the agents who were arrested," she said. "He told me to tell you not to worry and that he'd be back tonight." Of course he hadn't taken a burner phone with him. There was no way to contact him to see if he could pump information about Lillian Gray's whereabouts from this same friend. If she was still with the League, where were they keeping her? She'd been running her research near Georgia HQ with only a few agents assigned for her protection. Would they have brought her to Kansas HQ with the others when they closed the other location? I passed by the gym and did a double take at the sight of Zoo, Tommy, Pat, and a number of the others trying to fuss around with the exercise machines.
"Sorry," Pat ventured, stepping away from the weights. "We were just doing nothing, and we wanted to do something since, you know, we're going, me and Tommy."
"Going?" I repeated.
Tommy popped up next to him, bright red hair glowing under the bare lights overhead.
We volunteered. For Oasis. Sorry, we voted after you, left.
Ah. I looked at the two of them, sizing them up. When Tommy squirmed under the scrutiny, Pat smacked his side to get him to stop, forcing his chin up higher. I smiled.
Do you want to learn some self-defense? I asked.
I'm not sure if their reaction could have been more enthusiastic if I'd offered candy. The other kids abandoned the machines, darting over to the mats, where I instructed them to line up. I led them through stretches, taught them how to break out of different holds someone might have on them, and demonstrated, repeatedly, how to flip someone over your shoulder if you weren't a blue. And hours later, when we were finished, I couldn't say who was happier with how the day had turned out, me or them. Finally, Cole announced his arrival with three bangs against the tunnel door. I came barreling out of Alban's old office, abandoning the ancient op files I'd been looking through, and unlocked it. He gave a guarded, uncertain smile as he came up the stairs.
The others are back, too, he said. I told them to bring everything around to the garage's loading dock. Can you gather up the kids to help haul the stuff in? I'll go ahead and cut the chain so we can get the damn door open.
Cole, I said sharply as he started to walk away. He shuffled to a stop, turning his head slightly.
I'm sorry, Jim. They're looking for the agents, but they don't know either. Liam must have contacted Harry behind my back because he got in touch with me this morning to say he'd ask around. He's ex-Special Forces and still has a number of buddies in different branches of the military and government.
The mention of his stepfather brought a flash of the memory I'd seen in Cole's mind, and pain stirred in me. The man from his memory, his biological father, smiling down at their mother that way. Okay, I said quietly. Thanks for trying. He let out a shuddering breath and forced himself to shrug.
You okay?
Yeah, I said. Let me go get the others. I'll meet you down there. Cold night air filled the warehouse with a crisp, clean scent that reached us in the tunnel. The door at the other end was already open, waiting for us. But the moment I stepped through, I stopped dead in my tracks. The whole place looked as though they'd power washed it for hours on end. They hadn't been able to actually remove the junk from the building. It might have attracted too much unwanted attention. But they'd somehow fit everything together, using the four walls as the frame of a puzzle. They'd lined up all of the shelving units, made some new shelves out of the broken bunks, and created a workstation with the tools they'd found. The car lift and frame were still at the center of the expansive space, but it looked like they were piecing even that back together. Someone had outfitted it with wheels, at least. Two large SUVs and one white van had come up the loading ramp and were parked inside. I jogged over to Liam and Vida as they used their abilities to lift boxes out of the trunks and set them aside. Liam looked up as I came over, a familiar smile on his face. He waved the group coming in behind me over.
We're organizing by type. Set computers and electronics over there.
There was an actual, blissful sigh from one of the greens, which made him chuckle.
Food and water goes here. There should be a few bags of clothes, bedding. No, leave the stuff in the white van, he said, jogging over to shut the door. It's Cole's going to take care of that stuff.
Meaning, I'd guess, weapons for our locker. Vida was blank. Her expression didn't so much as flicker with annoyance as Chubbs pelted her with a series of endless questions. I wasn't sure she was even aware of what she was doing. There was that much of a visible, numb disconnect. Zoo came to stand beside me, her dark gaze meeting mine in question. I wanted to tell her not to worry about this, that I was coming to see the heavier your heart got, the stronger you had to be to keep carrying it around. But the truth was, all I wanted to do was risk a punch in the face and hug Vida. So, I tried. And she let me. Her arm stayed down around her sides, pinned there by my tight grip.
Slowly her hands rose and pressed against my back. I smelled dust and the salt of ocean water on her skin, mingling with the exhaust from the cars, and I wished like hell I had thought to volunteer to go instead, so she could have had the day to recover.
"We are going to fucking get her back," Vida said fiercely. "I will burn Gray's house down over his head.
If she's not all right,
I'm going to rip out his heart and eat it."
I nodded.
"You really shouldn't eat raw meat," Chubb said somewhere beside us. "It can carry pathogens."
We both turned to him slowly. He lowered the computer box he'd been holding down to the ground and backed away.
"The Canadians came through, didn't they?"
Senator Cruz looked around at the hall, strolling between the piles.
"What are they going to want for this stuff?"
one of the kids asked. "Don't worry about it," Senator Cruz said. "The reparations are still quite a ways off yet. This is what we'd call a favor." "Oh, did they not provide gas?"
"They sent a fuel tank," Liam said. "We hid it behind the bar since it wouldn't fit through this loading dock. I also did not, feel super comfortable having a ton of explosive material in here."
"Fair point," Senator Cruz said with a faint laugh.
"They seem really invested in this. We established a drop site so they can bring things down when they find openings. They gave me this."
He pulled a sleek silver phone out of his pocket.
"To make contact when the supplies are ready."
"Spray paint?"
Chubbs asked.
"Did you remember to grab that?"
"What for?" I asked.
"When we send the cars out to pick up the tribes,"
Liam explained, using his hands to add emphasis,
"they're going to mark the safe routes they take with the road code. That way we can get back in one piece, and there's a chance other kids we don't know about will catch on and follow the route in."
That smile on his face had always been contagious. I bit the inside of my lip. He was looking at me like I was the best damn thing he'd ever seen. "Ruby can take your memories."
"Great idea," I said, glancing away.
"Yeah."
His voice faltered.
"Thanks."
The kids were only too happy to cart the load off into the ranch. Cole stood at the back door of the white van, leaning against it as he watched the progress the kids were making around him.
"Wait,"
I said, catching Chubbs and Liam by the backs of their shirts before they could follow Zoo and Hina to the tunnel.
"We need to talk about something."
Cole and Vida must have picked up on the nerves in my voice because they came around into our huddle.
"I dealt with Clancy today," I said, "to find out where his mother is."
Cole straightened.
"And?"
"She'd been working out of some facility in Georgia, protected by the agents from the HQ there. They seem to have gotten her out in time. Her lab burnt down, though."
"Damn, girl,"
Vida said softly.
"You're sure?"
"Positive. And I doubt they would have let her out of their sight."
"You think they're hiding her in Kansas?"
Cole said.
"It makes sense, doesn't it?
It's league procedure that when the organization is under attack, remaining forces and resources fall back to a central, safe location. I don't know that they would risk keeping her in an external location anymore after what happened with Clancy, and I don't think she's the kind of prisoner they would have cut loose."
"Would they trade her?" Vida interrupted. "A prisoner exchange?"
"The First Lady?" Cole said. "Not even for 100 agents. I just don't understand why they wouldn't have used her before now. They aren't exactly shy about using hostages to make demands."
"Well, they might not want to put her in front of a camera," I said.
"Explain."
"Clancy tampered with her mind. Really tampered with it."
"Brain voodoo," Vida clarified.
"Awesome. So much for getting any answers."
"You want to go get her?"
Liam's voice was quiet, and I could hear the hint of unhappiness in it that went unspoken.
"You think you can fix whatever he did?"
I nodded.
You mean you want to send an extraction team into a secure facility, manned by 100 trained ex-soldiers who specialize in torture and terror, because you have a theory? Cole said.
If she's not there, then at least we'll find answers about where she is, I said. It'll be a quick in and out. It's not like we don't know where Kansas HQ is. Two of us could go, survey the situation. If it seems too dangerous, we'll back off. It's worth the risk. If we find her and I can fix her, we'll have answers about the cure. If not, then we'll have someone to trade for Kate.
Vida's interest in the op shot way up at that.
Promise me that we'll eventually trade her for Kate and I'm in.
You and me, we can do this. It's nothing we haven't done a dozen times before.
Chubbs groaned, putting a distressed hand to his face.
Don't tell us that. That makes it worse.
It can't be Ruby, Cole said. She's needed here, to deal with it.
I opened my mouth to protest.
Wait. Liam interrupted. Slow down. A few hours ago, you were worried about Agent Connor revealing the location of the ranch. But what if they spill their guts about Kansas HQ? What if they've already packed up and left?
Then we'll follow their trail, Vida said. Though I'll put $100 on the smug assholes feeling too invincible and secure to beat a hasty retreat. They're still there. $100.
I turned to Cole. If anyone is going in to bring him food, it's going to have to be you. I can pretty much guarantee he's not going to want to see my face for a while. Cole looked intrigued by this, but ultimately shook his head.
No, you're needed here. If not for that, then to lead the camp hit.
It would just be for a few days, I protested.
No, I mean it.
The others shifted uncomfortably as Cole and I stared each other down.
I'd offer, but I told the others I'd start organizing a search for the tribes, Liam said, running a hand back over his shaggy hair. I want to go out and try to find Olivia's group myself. I think I have an idea of where they are.
Really? I asked. Olivia and Brett and all of the other kids we'd met at Nashville had some experience with fighting. They'd be invaluable if they were willing to help. Chubb straightened his windbreaker, zipping it up with a startling amount of conviction.
I'll go with Vida.
There was a moment of total and complete silence.
No thanks, Vida said. Pretty sure it would be more helpful to bring a dish towel.
I still have my skip tracer credentials. It's just a matter of stopping somewhere to get a new ID made, he said, more to her than the others.
You? You were a skip tracer?
Cole started to laugh, only to realize the rest of us weren't.
Wow, oh, okay then. Why not? Continue.
I can access their network and GPS system to make sure we steer clear of them.
He swiveled toward Vida.
Also, screw you. Maybe you can be all stealthy and break into their building to get the woman out, but I can get us there and back safely. I did this for months and never got a second glance from anyone, including PSFs.
Probably because your ugly-ass face blinded them on the first look, she muttered.
Really? Ugly jokes? He hissed. Don't tell me you finally emptied out your arsenal of wit.
Liam stepped between them, blocking their view of each other, and still they kept slugging words to each other under their breath.
Look, Vida, I'm happy to agree to the trade you want, but the odds of pulling this off really aren't that great, kid, Cole said.
I can't even begin to predict what would happen if they caught you. How would you even play it?
By saying I was sick to death of how chicken shit everyone here is, and that I was ready to take an actual risk if it meant a huge payoff, she said pointedly. The payoff, in their minds, being that I want to enlist with them.
That's actually pretty plausible, I offered. To Vida, this wasn't about getting the cure. Her investment was 100% in the fact that this was a real avenue to getting Kate back. I wish I could have had her confidence. I wish I could have let myself believe that they'd keep her alive long enough to matter. But what was the point? It was easier to feel the numbness of certainty than live along the burning edge of hope.
All right, Vada, all right. You can go, as long as you take Skippy the Skip Tracer here with you. Unnecessary risks aren't an option. Do you understand?
I almost told him that the two of them had pretty much opposite definitions of unnecessary risks, but kept my mouth shut. I didn't like the idea of either of them being out of my sight for that long, let alone what could happen along the way. But if we were going to take a big risk, it needed to be for something like this.
You got it, Vida said. If you think I'm going to blow any chance to get Kate back, then you must be smoking the good stuff. Darling, I wish.
Cole, Liam, and I worked silently, hauling in one crate of weapons at a time. For once, I was grateful for the uneasy silence. No matter how unbearable the tension was, another fight would have been infinitely worse. There was a moment when I'd leaned forward to pick up a rifle and place it up on its proper rack in the weapons locker, and my sweatshirt had gaped. Liam had reached over and pulled the fabric down out of the way. He didn't comment on the bruise on the side of my neck, only smoothed the collar back up and turned away. When we were finished, he was the first one out of the room, disappearing through the double doors, heading, if I had to guess, back to the garage. I followed the route he'd taken, stopping to check our bunk room first. Most of the kids had checked out for the night, but the door to our room was open. Only Chubbs was inside, passed out on his bed with all the lights on, a book resting across his chest. I smiled and reached for the light switch when I noticed the colorful small box on Vida's bed. It took less than 30 seconds to figure out where she'd gone. The top of the hair dye box had been ripped straight off, meaning one thing. The ventilation in the bathrooms was bad enough that we had to prop both of the doors partly open to keep the spaces from feeling like the South in late summer. The steam had been thick enough to make me lightheaded.
That's okay, you know, Vida was saying. But that's a really shitty way to live.
I paused outside of the door, one hand pressed against it as I leaned forward, catching the one-sided conversation.
Yeah, but doesn't it bother you? She continued. Aren't there things that are important enough to say? I know you can write it out, don't get me wrong, but how are you ever really going to get this shit off your chest if you can't talk it through? I mean, look, Z, you know I feel you, but the only person that's being hurt with this silence is you. Don't give them that power. Don't let them trap you into never saying anything. There are people worth remembering, speaking up for. You're important. You deserve to speak and have people shut the hell up and listen to you. You're smarter than 90% of our population.
I closed my eyes, pulling back to lean against the wall.
Aw, girl. I get scared too, Vida said. I'm always a little scared when I go out on an op. Not like shit my pants scared, but I'm afraid of what could happen to the others if I screw up or don't cover them well enough. Our friend Rue owes me about 5 years of my life back.
She paused, likely waiting for Zoo to write something.
Thing is, though, fear is worthless. It stops you when you need to keep moving most, and it only exists inside of your head. You can hate yourself for being scared, but that's still letting it control your life. Aren't you tired of that same old shit? It's just going to keep dragging you down.
There was another pause, long enough that I started to open the door again.
People come in and out of our lives all the time, Vida said, her voice tight. They can promise that they'll be right back, but you might never see them again. We got a good unit here, and you know why it's so strong? Because we chose it. We made it.
My sister, she wasn't like your parents, but she still left me. The bitch called in my location for a reward, but I won't let her win. I won't give her the satisfaction of not letting myself trust anyone ever again.
She didn't choose me, and now
I'm choosing a different family. I waited until Vida was back to humming a little song before slipping inside.
Hey, girl, what's doing?
Vida glanced over. For once, the smell of bleach wasn't coming from the cleaning products we used to scrub out the showers, but from the thick cream Vida had combed through her short hair. There was an old ratty towel over her shoulders to catch the gooey mixture before it hit her sports bra. For a second, I couldn't see anything other than the scar tissue on her shoulders from the burns she'd gotten in Nashville, fighting Mason. It made my stomach go sour. Zoo sat perched on the counter next to her, swinging her legs back and forth, little white socks bobbing up and down through the air. She held up two different boxes in her hands for me to see, one blue, one red, then gestured toward Vida.
I made Boy Scouts stop on our way back from Oregon,
Vida explained, taking the towel from her shoulders and wrapping it around Zoo's much smaller ones.
Glad I did, too. Had to get my war paint on to go into battle tomorrow.
I gave her a look in the mirror.
Fine. My carefully planned, reasonably cautious reconnaissance mission.
Vida cocked a brow.
You sure you and me can't just sneak out tonight?
Chubbs is useful, I reminded her. Please try not to kill him.
Yeah, we'll see. All I'm saying is, accidents happen.
Before I could even think of questioning it, she used her gloved fingers to scoop some of the product out from the cup she'd mixed it in and made a thin stripe of it in Zoo's hair. My mind blanked, cutting quickly to how Liam, and worse, Chubbs, would react to this development. Zoo glanced back in the mirror and made an impatient gesture, like, more! Vida shook her head.
Start with that and see if you like it first. Did you decide which color?
She'd rather have pink, I said. Zoo whipped around to look at Vida again, her eyes wide with the possibility. Vida cocked her head to the side, looking at the two boxes.
I could try mixing a separate batch and using a little less of the red dye than I normally would. Might not work, but it's worth a shot.
Zoo nodded eagerly, flashing me a big smile.
Charlie boy's going to kill me, Vida sang out, leaning back against the counter. But we don't give a damn what boys think, do we, girlfriend?
I laughed, startled.
Charlie boy? Well, I mean, his name is Charles, right?
Vida said quickly, glaring at me in the mirror's reflection.
How is Chubbs any better?
Good point, I said.
Well, I'll leave you guys to it.
Where's the fire, Boo?
Vida asked, hopping up on the counter next to Zoo.
Stay a while. It seems like we haven't seen your face around much.
I hesitated, knowing that I still needed to find Liam. But how could I say no when for the first time in days, Zoo looked like her old self, when I'd missed seeing their faces, too?
All right, I said, reaching for the bowl of dye. Let's see if we can get you the perfect shade of pink.
13. After lying awake for 3 hours in the dark, counting Chubbs's snores, waiting for Liam to come back, I finally pushed myself up off the stiff mattress and headed for the hallway. I wouldn't bother him, but I just needed to make sure he was where I thought he was. The music flowing down the tunnel to the garage was a pretty good hint I was on the right track. The Rolling Stones. Mick Jagger was crooning about wild horses, the promise in his voice stopping me just outside of the door. I thought of the CD he'd brought in for me, the note that was still hidden inside, and felt caught between the need to go in and the need to walk back to the bunk room, slide under a blanket, and disappear. There were a few kids lingering around the space. One was working at the table along the opposite wall, her back hiding whatever it was she was doing. The others were playing cards on a blanket they'd spread out over the floor. It was strange to me that they were down here instead of using the chairs and tables in the big room upstairs, where it had to be at least 20 degrees warmer. I stepped forward, wrapping my arms around my center to try to trap some warmth in. There was a sticky pull at the bottom of my shoes. I glanced at the ground and immediately jumped away.
A large white crescent moon. Someone must have painted it there earlier in the night. Liam had his back to me as he crouched down, working on the motorbike he'd found. Its gray shell of grime had been polished away, and the silver accents and black panels gleamed under his care. It looked like he'd just brought it home from the store. He stood up suddenly, reaching for a piece of foam, and started to wrap it over the bike's seat to cover the gashes in the leather.
"I like what you've done with the place!"
I had to shout over Mick Jagger to be heard. The radio stood a foot away from my feet, and somehow I had the feeling that I didn't have the right to turn it off. You listened to music this loudly to drown out everyone and everything, letting the rhythm and beats flow around you like a shield. Liam spun around, startled. His white shirt was spotted with oil and dust, and somehow, clearly without realizing it, he'd managed to wipe some of it across his forehead and cheek. It was disarming how good he looked to me, how much I wanted to go straight toward him, take his face in between my hands and kiss him, and kiss him and kiss him until that carefree smile was back. It made me forget everything that had happened between the start of this and now. My mind was still on blown-out tires, socks, and the Beach Boys, even as he said, "What's wrong?" "Nothing," I managed. I was worried when you didn't show up for lights out. I wanted to
make sure I didn't run away."
"Really?" He started to turn back to his bike, but stopped midway, pressing his hand to his forehead.
"Oh, damn. I did do that, didn't I? That was not Nashville, right?"
The small bubble of contented memory popped around me. "It was Oklahoma, at the national park."
"Right, right. That's the last foggy part, right before you..."
He waved a hand through the air.
"Sorry, we need a clock in here."
My eyes drifted over his profile, the line of his jaw, and I thought with crushing certainty, I'm not wanted here.
"Okay, well," I said, forcing a horrible brightness into my voice. "Okay, I'm just going to get going."
My throat was aching by the time I finally got the words out, and I had a feeling they didn't make sense either. Stupid, so stupid. I'd wanted distance, hadn't I? I hadn't wanted to talk to him about everything, and now it was like I'd forgotten how to talk to him entirely. I got a step away when the music got quieter, and he called out,
"I'm thinking of calling her Lovely Rita. What do you think?"
In spite of everything, I felt myself smile.
"Like the Beatles song?"
He was leaning against the motorbike seat, his legs out in front of him, his arms crossed over his chest. I made a mental amendment. This was the best thing I'd ever seen. This was the first time Liam had looked like Liam in months, from his wild, kept running his hands through it hair to the way his jeans were slung low on his hips.
"Fits, right?"
he said, offering the smallest, sweetest little smile.
"Isn't Rita a meter maid?"
I asked, walking back over to him, my heart thrumming in my chest. Liam was watching me so intently, I almost tripped over my own careless feet. The warmth that pooled at my center threatened to spark when his arm slid forward, his hands turned up, toward me. I stepped into the circle of them and leaned against his shoulder.
"Yeah," he said quietly, "but she's so lovely."
My hand slid up along his back, and I was relieved that it was as hot to the touch as I felt. I wanted to ask him about the drive up, what the people they made contact with had been like, but it seemed enough to just be held, to feel him kiss my hair, my cheek. I leaned back, looking up at his face. One of his hands moved, sliding into the back pocket of my jeans. He was still watching me when I reached up and tried to thumb some of the oil off his face.
"Damn," he said, chuckling. "How much of a mess am I right now?"
"You are perfect."
My fingers and eyes shifted down to the pale scar at the right corner of his mouth and felt the first touch of something dark and insistent pressing at the back of my mind. "How did you get this scar?" I asked. I just needed to hear it from him, to confirm what I'd seen locked inside Cole's mind. "I never asked you."
"It's a good thing you didn't,"
he said, reaching up to catch my hand and hold it in his.
"There's not a good story to it. I've had it forever. Cole told me I got it when he pushed me off his bed."
I closed my eyes, let out a soft breath, and when he kissed me, I let it chase the truth away. "Cole said you called Harry to help find where they brought Kate," I said.
"Thank you. Thank you so much. I know you're trying to keep them out of this."
Liam laughed. "Like I could ever keep Harry or Mom from getting themselves in trouble. Zoo's story pretty much proved that."
"You got to talk to them?"
"Yeah, I used one of the extra burner phones," he said. "It was amazing to hear their voices. It felt like it had been forever since the last time."
I ran a hand up and down his arm. I was thrilled for him. Honestly thrilled beyond anything I thought possible. Enough, at least, to ignore the small pang of jealousy in the corner of my heart that was still bruised.
"I was worried he wouldn't accept Harry's help," Liam continued. "The two of them have knocked heads since day one."
"Why is that?" I asked. "If he hated his biological father the way I knew he did, then why push back so hard against Harry?"
He shrugged. "Cole used to act out a lot when we were kids, and Mom didn't have the heart to discipline him after everything that happened with our bio dad, so Harry had to do it. And you know, he's a great, loving, super funny guy, but he can be strict. He spent years in the military."
"And Cole has never liked being told what to do," I finished. That, and I was sure that once the change came over him, and he developed terrifying abilities he had to fight to control, he spent most of his childhood angry and afraid of being found out. I swallowed hard at the thought, unable to speak. If he'd just tell Liam.
"I think he was... I'm not sure this is going to make sense, but I don't know that Cole ever let himself trust Harry. He remembers more of what it was like when our father was around, and he feels protective of Mom, which I do get, but it's like he's waiting for Harry to let us down, to hurt us, and Harry never would. I think he joined the League just to spite Harry, actually."
"Maybe working together now will help Cole learn to trust him," I offered.
"That's what Harry's hoping. For the record, I hope so too."
Liam pressed a kiss to my hair again before pulling back.
"All right, I'm tuckered out."
I wasn't tired in the slightest anymore, and I had a feeling he wasn't either, not really. I kissed the scar at the corner of his lips, running my hands up his neck and burying them in his hair. His pale blue eyes seemed to darken as he leaned down to meet me halfway. Someone coughed behind us, and coughed again. Liam said something uncharacteristically vulgar under his breath as he pulled back, his face flushed and his eyes a bit too wild.
"Yeah."
It was the girl who'd been working at the table. She was a blue who'd come in with Zoo's ragtag group. Elizabeth. That was her name. Liza.
"I finished, but I'm not sure it looks... I think it might look more like a white banana."
She held up a black helmet for the two of us to inspect. Painted along one side was what looked to my eye like a crescent moon. Liam's arms tensed around my waist.
"It looks great," he said.
"Well, you know what it's supposed to be, but what if she can't?" Liza said.
"She?" I repeated.
"Our contact," Liam said quickly. "Senator Cruz's, I mean. When I go to pick up supplies, she wanted something to identify me."
"But won't you be driving a car or truck?" I asked. "Not the bike." He hesitated, standing up and away from the bike. I saw the effort of his concentration as he turned a smiling face back on me.
Sometimes the bike, depending on the situation, will paint one of the doors of the trucks, too.
I don't know what it was, exactly. The odd tone of his voice, the way Liza all but bolted, her face pale, how quick he was to take my hand and start guiding us back toward the tunnel. Every thought that passed through his head had always registered on Liam's face, good or bad. Seeing his carefully blank face, half hidden by the shadows in the tunnel, I pieced together the realization. He was keeping secrets, too. Vida and Chubbs left the next morning, long before the sun came up. Liam, Zoo, and I were all there to see them off at the tunnel's entrance. Regardless of whether or not we'd been planning on it, the two of them had been bickering so loudly from the moment the alarm on Liam's watch went off that none of us had any chance of falling back asleep. Nico and Cole showed up a few minutes later, both pale and drained with an exhaustion that hadn't come with waking up at that ungodly hour, but staying awake to meet it. It set me on edge, the way they wouldn't make eye contact with any of us. When I asked Cole what was going on, he only said,
"We'll talk about it after."
As Vida went over the map one last time with Liam and Cole, I pulled Chubbs aside and walked him a short ways down the hall. I could see him fighting inside himself for some composure. Chubbs was so ruled by his head, by logic, that he didn't have a coping mechanism for when powerful emotions threatened his careful process. I don't think he was afraid for himself, so much as afraid of what could happen while they were gone.
"Don't do anything stupid," he started. "Be safe. Make sure that you seek out proper medical attention."
"Isn't that the lecture I'm supposed to be giving you?" I asked.
"Yo, no time to chat and hug it out," Vida called. "Let's get cracking."
Chubbs held up a finger to signal to the others that we needed a minute. Vida let out an impatient snort, then turned a very different finger in his direction. "I have no doubt you guys are going to pull this off," I began. "But how are you going to get through it without one of you strangling the other?"
"Well, we're pretty evenly matched," he said reasonably. "She has the brawn, I have the brains. Either both of us will come back, or neither of us will, because we'll have clawed each other's throats out."
"Don't even joke about it," I whispered.
"I have to joke about it. Otherwise, I'll probably start crying."
Chubbs's face suddenly looked as drawn as I felt. "You don't have to go if you don't want to," I said quickly. "It's not too late."
"Isn't it? Besides, I have to pull my weight, too."
He shrugged with a nonchalance that looked unnatural on him. His voice sounded strained, filtered through a lump in his throat. "You and Vida will both be fine," I said, planting both hands on his shoulders and forcing him to look down and meet my gaze. "You have everything under control. You'll both be careful and quick and back in one piece." Chubbs turned back toward Vida, who was the only person I knew who could make pacing look like prowling.
"Well,"
he amended with a long-suffering look,
"hopefully no more than two pieces."
Despite what Vida had said, she waited patiently as Chubbs knelt to talk to Zoo and gave Liam a good pounding on the back. Cole unlocked the door, letting a draft of cold air into the hallway, and stood back as Chubbs took the first few steps down. As much faith as I had in them, I did have to fight off the urge to throw myself in front of the tunnel out and block their path. I pressed a hand against my chest, trying to stamp the feeling of panic out. But Zoo had no such reservations. She bolted out of Liam's grip and pushed past Cole, who was shutting the door after them. By the time we caught up to them, she was gripping their packs, her heels digging into the unfinished floor, crying in that silent, heartbreaking way, crying harder than I'd ever seen. She shook her head, her lips moving with silent pleas. Chubbs looked back at us, startled. Zoo had been the toughest of our group in many ways, the one quickest to bounce back after terror or sadness knocked her flat. Whatever walls she'd built up to keep the feelings from cresting, they weren't high enough now to stop the desperate fear. And it devastated me. My throat ached with the need to cry, too. Vida dropped her pack and knelt down in front of her.
Hey, girl, none of that.
It's like what we talked about, yeah?
Zu pressed her face against Chubbs's backpack.
What happened to you with that guy? The one who drove you to California?
That was some... I saw her catch herself, modify her word choice.
That was some messed up stuff. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that it happened to him. But me and Charlie Boy,
we're coming back.
None of us are going to leave you here alone. We take care of our family, right?
I didn't realize Liam still had a hand on my shoulder until it tightened. His face was ashen. That calmed Zu down, at least enough to release her grip on Chubbs and turn toward Vida fully.
You can trust me, Z. I won't let you down, okay?
She nodded, scrubbing at her face with her sleeve. Vida held up her fist for a bump, but Zu one-upped her, wrapping her bony arms around the older girl's neck. Vida said something too low for any of the rest of us to hear, but when Zu pulled back, she was nodding, a look of fierce determination on her face. With no other warning, she turned and hugged Chubbs, too, looking back to point a finger toward Vida as if to say, "Be nice."
"I told you," Vida said as she stood. "I keep my promises."
Liam stepped forward to guide Zu back into the hallway so she didn't have to watch the door shut and lock behind them. I saw her straighten herself out, her fists clenching at her sides and her chin lifting up, the same way I'd seen Vida prep herself for battle.
"Let's go get something to eat, okay?"
Liam said. He looked back over his shoulder.
"Coming?"
I shook my head. "Have to shower and take care of a few things. I'll catch up with you later." Liam waved and started walking with Zu back down the hall, heading to the kitchen in the lower level.
"Okay, what's going on?" I asked before either Cole or Nico could speak. "What happened last night?"
"It's easier to show you."
Cole started past me, heading the same way his brother had taken, toward the stairs. I followed him silently, watching Nico watch the floor, my stomach clenching. It was getting too hard to pretend like I didn't care. It was the first time I'd been down in the computer room since the supplies had come in last night. Where there had once been only one laptop, there were now 5 desktops. Another 3 silver laptops were spaced out along the desks, which were still pushed against the walls, leaving an empty space at the center of the room for planning. I spotted a printer and a scanner near the old laptop. Nico had picked a seat at the far back corner of the room, as usual. Cole brushed aside printouts of indecipherable code from one of the nearby seats and offered it to me. Nico keyed in some kind of a password and brought up a window of more code.
"Somehow this doesn't feel easier," I said. "What are we looking at?"
"This is our server log," Nico said. "It seemed like it was lagging last night, so I was trying to troubleshoot what the issue was. This right here,"
he pointed to the screen.
"That means someone sent one of the files saved there, transferring it via FTP to another encrypted server."
"What file?" I asked.
"It was one of the videos from the Thurmond testing," Cole said. "But there's more."
Nico scrolled up.
"There are gaps in the server's activity log, all between the hours of midnight and 4 a.m. on 2 other days."
"It's not because no one was awake to use the computers?" I asked.
Nico shook his head.
"We've been leaving the computers on overnight to transfer everything to remote backup servers in case ours fail. There would have been huge spikes of activity, but look."
The huge spikes of activity were there, beginning at 11 o'clock in the evening, but abruptly cutting off at 2 in the morning, only to resume 4 hours later, right around the time Nico or another Green would first roll in to start the day's work.
"Is there really no way to tell who did it?" I asked, squinting at the screen.
"It was a Green," Nico said.
"It might have been a Green," Cole said.
"No,"
Nico insisted.
"It had to have been a Green. How many kids actually know how to erase server activity?"
"Okay," I said. That made sense, unfortunately.
"But if they went to such great lengths to hide the other instances,
Would they have left this blip for someone to find? Nico shrugged.
Maybe they were interrupted, or they were in such a hurry they didn't have time.
Cole asked another question that disappeared beneath the rush of blood in my ears as I stared at the screen, blinking to clear the blurriness that turned it into nothing more than a glowing square.
Think.
Cole touched my shoulder to get my attention, making me jump.
Sorry, I said quickly, avoiding their stares.
I'm tired. What did you just ask?
My theory is one of the computers just glitched, or there's a problem with the server, Cole said, his eyes soft with concern.
Occam's razor, Nico said. Make the fewest assumptions. The simplest solution is usually the right one.
I don't know anything about a razor, but who the hell would kids be sending the intel to?
Cole asked.
Who'd be stupid enough to try to sell information at the risk of getting their asses caught and hauled into a camp?
Could it be someone from Kansas HQ accessing files remotely? I asked Nico. He shook his head.
It's someone here.
Damn. I shared a look with Cole.
I want to believe it's a one-off thing, he said, but keep digging. Let me know if they try anything again, okay?
There was a knock on the windows running along the side of the room. Kylie, dressed in all black, her hair tied into a poofy bun.
Ah, Cole said. That'll be the groups leaving this morning to try to track down those tribes in Montana. You two figure the camera situation out, okay?
Wait, I said. They're leaving this morning? Where did the cars come from?
They're taking the SUVs Lee rounded up for yesterday's haul, he said, stretching as he stood.
I followed him to the door, listening to him rattle off instructions about training and which weapons to pull from the locker for training the next day. But when I reached the door, I didn't follow him out into the hall. I stepped back into the computer room and caught sight of the whiteboard out of the corner of my eye. Someone, likely Cole, had started scribbling information on it. Coordinates, camp populations, number of PSFs assigned, anything and everything the League might have had in its files. Peppered through were details from Clancy's documents. I saw tidbits about the camp controllers tossed in like afterthoughts. The basic outline of the Oasis plan was there, too. I found my name written next to Influence Camp Controller in Charge of Communications.
You don't have to stay, Nico said. I can do this myself.
I know. I picked up the dry erase marker from the ledge and started to fill in additional information about Thurmond, fleshing out sections of the plan where I could.
It was your strategy,
Nico said over the warm purring of the machines around us.
Right? It seemed like you.
What do you mean?
A little reckless, smart, but not giving attention to the details.
Really? I said dryly, turning back to face him. He kept his back to me the whole time, shoulders bunched up with tension. I'd really been a monster to him, hadn't I? There seemed to be a 5-foot radius around me that Nico was too frightened to cross. I fought to keep from cringing at the thought of how badly I'd mistreated him.
How would you do it?
I jerked my chin in the direction of the blank space under the word Thurmond, trying to ignore the way it seemed to be taunting the both of us. He stared at me, and 60 full seconds of awkwardness passed before he took a tentative step closer.
It doesn't matter what I think.
You said I wasn't paying attention to the details, I prompted. What did you mean by that? Nico looked down at the floor, running his shoes over the tile. I had a fleeting thought of how Vida used to call the Greens squeakers, because of the way they all seemed to shuffle their feet as they walked.
The Oasis plan is okay, he said finally. The way we have it now makes sense. Based on the size of the camp, there'll only be 2 or 3 camp controllers, and it'll be easy for you to figure out who is in charge of security and sending the status updates to their network. It won't work that way at Thurmond.
I watched him wring his hands, still unable to look at me.
There's going to be, what, 2 dozen camp controllers in the control tower?
That was the estimate in Clancy's files. Its position at the center of the camp means that anyone forcing their way in through the gate is going to have to fight through all of the rings of cabins to get to it to subdue the PSFs and controllers inside. And by then, the camp controllers will have called for reinforcements. Even if you found a way to subdue all of them, it would still be too late. All they'd have to do is turn on the white noise and we'd be done. The power generator and backup generator are all on the camp premises, and I have a feeling cutting the power would automatically trigger an alarm on the military's network. In the space of 2 minutes, he'd managed to chisel my confidence down to dust. So we'll need a bigger attack force, one that can work faster, get them in and out. Liam's idea about trying to get the parents to storm the camp might work, he offered, but its success depends half on us being able to inspire civilians to revolt and come after the camps, and half on whether or not the PSFs would fire on civilians or figure out some other way to deter them.
He has an actual plan? I asked.
Not in the technical definition of the word. I just heard some kids asking him about what he would do.
Nico shrugged.
His option isn't perfect either.
Is there a third option? I asked. Finally, Nico stood up and, with tentative, halting steps, walked beside me. I tried to offer him the marker, but he didn't take it.
Are you sure you want to know?
Try me.
The only way I can think of to disable the camp controller's access to the camp's systems, not even disable or disarm the system itself, but lock them out and keep the system running so no one outside notices anything amiss, is to install a Trojan horse program in their system and control it remotely. They'll be so disoriented that the tactical team will have an easier time of it.
Is that something we could upload into their server? The League had given us a limited education on technology and the way viruses worked, but this was out of my depth.
No, the programs don't install automatically like a virus. Someone has to install it, he said. And with all of the security safeguards in place, I don't think one of them would carelessly download any kind of email attachment.
So someone would have to go into Thurmond and install it before the assault, I said. But the camp has been closed to new kids for years.
They take escaped kids back into the camp they were originally processed in,
Nico said quietly.
I already started coding the Trojan horse. Cole told me to.
I held up a hand to cut him off. Cole approved this already? He nodded, eyes wide.
He said he'd talk to you about it. I can have it ready in a week. They'll be powerless to stop it once the program is installed.
I felt every last drop of blood drain out of my head in horror.
No,
I said, horrified.
No way. I meant me, Nico said quickly. Not you. I could bring the Trojan horse program in on a flash drive, the same way we're bringing the cameras into Oasis. Glasses frames. Have you seen them?
Nico crossed the room, retrieving a pair of glasses with black plastic frames. I had to lean against the desk to stay vertical.
Nico.
No.
It's already installed. Right there, he said, ignoring me and pointing to one of two shiny silver screws that looked like they were holding the frames together. This is the camera, and this is just a screw the frames don't need. We had to make them seem as real as possible. Tommy said they're fine, so he'll get this pair. For Thurmond, maybe I could take one of the thicker frames, break up one of the arms that hooks behind the ear, and replace a piece of it with a small flash drive. It's either that or embedding it under my skin. But they still do strip searches, don't they? The cut would be too obvious.
Nico, I interrupted. Listen to me. No. There's no way in hell you're going back in there. Even if they brought you back into the camp, how would you get yourself into the control tower to upload it? You haven't been there since the camp changed. They don't just let you walk around unsupervised. Every move you make in there is choreographed down to the minute, and it's the most fortified building in the camp. He paused, trying to think this through.
I'd need to observe the schedules of the PSFs, figure out a moment I could slip away. It doesn't matter if they catch me in the end. Not really. It would be okay. I would get to... There's not anyone left for me now that Kate's gone, and this is how I could make it right.
His voice dropped to a whisper.
This is how I could make it right for Jude.
I stood straight up at that, whirling around to face him fully. Throwing yourself into danger? Throwing your life away? What would Jude say about that? What would Kate say? I haven't been a good friend to you these past few weeks, but Nico, I swear to God, please, I forgive you. I do. I understand what happened, and I'm sorry I treated you the way I did. I've been up in my own head too much, and it was hard for me to see things clearly. But please listen to me.
It's okay.
Nico's voice was hoarse. It's not. It wasn't. It wasn't even remotely all right how I'd been acting, blaming him for everything, hating him because I couldn't function if all of my energy went into hating myself. I tried to think of what Jude would say and do in this situation, or even Kate. All those times she'd had to talk the kid out of a manic fit about some conspiracy. We can't change what happened in Los Angeles. I was angry. I was so damn angry that he just slipped away and I couldn't save him. I should have talked to you, should have helped you, or at least tried to understand what you'd done. I let everyone down, but it was easier to blame you. It hurt less. But the truth is, I knew what Clancy was capable of. I should have tried to confirm some other way that what he said was true. And you know what? Jude would have wanted to go anyway, even if I said no.
He was my best friend,
Nico choked out.
I know, but it's different with Clancy, isn't it?
I said quietly. Rules don't apply when you love someone, and that's how it was with Clancy, right? It's not like how you loved Jude, or the way I love Chubbs. I'd known it the moment I saw his face in Clancy's memory. The tortured expression and the ragged sobs were only part of it. It was the way Nico had held the other boy, how he'd fed him and cleaned him with every ounce of tenderness he had in him. You see it in others, I thought, when you recognize it in yourself. You trusted him, and he took your words and twisted them for his own ends. I said. I was so angry with you for believing him, for giving him everything you did. But I know firsthand that people are capable of doing things for the people they love that they never would have considered before. Nico buried his face in his hands, letting out a shuddering breath.
I didn't mean to ruin everything,
he whispered.
I trusted him. All the intel I gave him, he swore he was using to help us, and I thought...
You thought that he would help keep us away and safe, didn't you? I finished for him. I know. It sounds to me like maybe you fell into my pattern for a while there.
I don't know why. I knew it was wrong, that it was bad, but he was good. When I knew him, he was good and he helped me. And I just extrapolated it would apply to everyone else. The only reason you were there was because I forecast the results incorrectly. I didn't factor all of his behavioral outliers in.
His voice became so small, I had to lean in that much closer to hear him.
He wasn't always the way he is now. They broke something in him. I'm sorry, I said, for not letting you explain, for acting the way I did and not being there for you.
I have to fix this, he said, voice ragged. I have to make things right. I can't stop thinking about all of the other outcomes we could have had. Vita said if you hadn't been there, we wouldn't have had the cure, but we don't have it, do we? It was for nothing.
It was a punch to the gut. I felt tears spring to my eyes and fought to hold them back. The pain in him was unending. His life was tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy. And I'd ignored him, punished him.
Vida hadn't made any real attempt. Kate had left altogether.
He didn't have anyone to help him through this. We'd stranded him out in a dark sea without so much as a life vest.
We can make it right, I said, taking him by the shoulders. You've done so much already, but there's still so much left. We'll figure out another way.
You have no logical reason to trust me, Nico said.
You may have noticed this about me, but I've never been good at listening to logic.
That's true, he agreed. It's not your pattern. Jude liked that. He said you knew when it was okay to break the rules to help people. He said you were like a superhero, because you always tried to do good things, even if the odds were bad.
Jude's pattern was exaggeration, I said, hoping he didn't catch the hitch in my voice. Nico nodded, his jet black hair falling forward into his face. He looked sick to me, sick in body, mind, and heart. The pallor of his usually golden brown skin made it look like his ghost had already up and left his body.
Jude never made logical decisions, but he tried. He tried. He tried so hard at everything with everyone. Ruby, what does the future look like?
Nico asked.
I can't picture it. I try all the time, but I can't imagine it. Jude said it looked like an open road just after a rainstorm.
I turned back toward the board, eyes tracing those 8 letters, trying to take their power away, change them from a place, a name, to just another word. Certain memories trap you. You relive their 1,000 tiny details. The damp, cool spring air, swinging between snow flurries and light rain. The hum of the electric fence. The way Sam used to let out a small sigh each morning we left the cabin. I remembered the path to the factory, the way you never forgot the story behind a scar. The black mud would splatter over my shoes, momentarily hiding the numbers written there. 3, 2, 8, 5. Not a name. You learned to look up, craning your neck back to gaze over the razor wire curled around the top of the fence. Otherwise, it was too easy to forget that there was a world beyond the rusting metal pen they'd thrown all of us animals into.
I see it in colors, I said. A deep blue, fading into golds and reds, like fire on a horizon. Afterlight. It's a sky that wants you to guess if the sun is about to rise or set.
Nico shook his head.
I think I like Jude's better.
Me too, I said softly.
Me too.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.